to order, June 23rd, 2005. I want to welcome the senators that have come over. We've invited them specifically because they've been a big part of the work group. They need to hear the testimony that we're going to receive today. I'm asking them to take a very active part other than when we vote.
We'll
go as far as we can, but that will be beyond what we can go. We have a couple short matters with some conflict amendments with a couple of bills, and so we're going to go ahead and take care of that now. Open a work session on Senate Bill 239 for possible reconsideration and work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 239.
Representative McPherson has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 239. The motion is undebatable. Those are who are in favor of suspending the rules will say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 239 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 239 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any committee discussion? Those are opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 239 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation will say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to resolve conflicts into Senate Bill 239.
Okay, Representative McPherson moves that the dash one amendments to resolve conflicts to Senate Bill 239. Mr. Taylor, can you talk to us about the amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 239 creates consistency throughout the Oregon anti-discrimination laws concerning who is protected, and it has a conflict with another bill that comes to us from the Oregon Law Commission, Senate Bill 237. Which specify statute of limitations for filing civil actions for discrimination based on exercise of rights under workplace safety statutes. This is a bill you probably remember that it puts a statute of limitations on those issues. And both bills amend ORS 654.062. Senate Bill 237 is already enrolled. Senate Bill 239 is the last bill. And if it were to pass without this conflict amendment, it would negate part of 237, and I don't think that was our intent.
All right. Any discussion on the motion? Have a motion on the amendment? You've done that. Excuse me. Okay, those are the opinion that the dash one amendments to resolve the conflicts to Senate Bill 239 be adopted will say aye.
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 Opposed? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Those of opinion that we should send Senate Bill 239 to the floor with a due pass will say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Ackerman, can you carry the bill?
I will, thank you.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 392.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended with the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 392.
Representative McPherson moves that rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 392. The motion is undebatable. Those who are of the opinion that rules should be suspended will vote aye. Those aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 392 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 392 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Those are the opinion that we should consider this. Was there any discussion on that portion? All right. Those are the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 392 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to resolve conflicts into Senate Bill 392.
Representative McPherson moves that the dash one amendments to resolve conflicts to Senate Bill 392. Can you tell us about the
conflicts? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 392 is a bill that clarifies that a person who cannot inherit by interstate succession or through will or trust that the person is a slayer of the person to whom the property passes. This bill was intended, you may remember, to address the issue that actually happened to a certain extent up in Deschutes County. A wife murders husband. The husband's sole heir is the son. The son is underage. He cannot make a will. If the son dies, the wife would inherit through the son. Under current law, if you murder someone, you can't inherit from them. So indirectly, this situation could happen. What this bill is a conflict amendment with is House Bill 2415, which is a bill dealing with establishing the rules governing passage of property from elderly incapacitated persons where there's abuse. And that bill says that you cannot inherit if you abuse the person. In the conflict amendment, Legislative Council's office, in making it consistent with 392, also added a provision that would say that you could not inherit in the same way through 392. So in other words, if you abuse someone and you cannot inherit from them, the person subsequently dies, the property goes, for example, to someone else, and they die, you can't inherit the property that way either.
Any discussion on the amendments? Okay, those are the opinion that the dash one amendments to resolve conflict to Senate Bill 392 be adopted. We'll say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 392 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson has moved Senate Bill 392 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any committee discussion? Objections? Those are the opinion that we send Senate Bill 392 to the floor with a due pass recommendation amended. We'll say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative McPherson, you're still the carrier.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2485, and I ask Heidi to kind of review the information that the work group received over the last couple times that we've met, because we're going to pretty much contain ourselves to the changes, because everything else in the bill was discussed during the joint House and Senate hearings that we held in this room. So I want Heidi to go through those, and then we'll start calling some witnesses up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and senators who are visiting our committee. What we did in the work group was we asked for two sets of amendments, and you have those before you today. There is a dash three amendment and a dash four amendment. The major change from the dash two amendment is the pseudoephedrine regulation. The dash two amendments, you may recall, banned all hard tablets outright in the state of Oregon and would have clarified the Board of Pharmacy's authority to regulate liquid and gel caps if that became a problem in the state, if there was sufficient evidence to believe that meth cooks were using the liquid and gel cap preparations. Since that time, you may recall, I believe it was Mr. Durbin from the Oregon State Police, and his testimony included photographs of gel caps being used in Oregon. The state has the dubious distinction of being the first state to have a gel cap lab found by law enforcement. And so in reconsidering the position, the work group determined that there was no justification for differentiating between pseudoephedrine products, meaning multi versus single ingredient, liquid, gel cap, hard tablet, and instead determined that the pseudoephedrine should be regulated the same regardless of the preparation. The question is then, in the dash threes, we would make all products containing pseudoephedrine Schedule 3 controlled substances, and I know there is a witness from the Board of Pharmacy who's available today to talk to us about the practical effect of a Schedule 3 designation. The Dash 4 amendments would allow the Board of Pharmacy to move all pseudoephedrine products behind the counter. So that is the primary difference between the two amendments. There were some other minor amendments that we made. Just to briefly touch on those, Section 7 was the portion of the bill that confers immunity on persons who report precursor transactions. And you may recall that the Attorney General, Hardy Meyer, suggested some alternative language. Upon a review, we did adopt the language that Attorney General Hardy Meyer suggested. The criminal defense lawyers had some concerns about preparing a precursor substance for the manufacture of methamphetamine. That's used throughout, actually, both 2485 and 907. We changed that to grinding, soaking, or otherwise breaking down a precursor substance for the manufacture to narrow the focus of when, and that's primarily for sentencing enhancements and for, example, the knowingly possessing or disposing of methamphetamine manufacturing waste sections and the child neglect and criminal mistreatment sections in 907. We have made it clear that there has to be something more going on than simply scraping the red phosphorus off of the matchbooks or popping the pills out of the blister packs. So we did do that. The anhydrous ammonia sections, which are later in the bill, there was in the original Dash 2 version an immunity provision that persons who sold or used an anhydrous ammonia with the additives that would make the anhydrous ammonia turn pink, that they would be conferred immunity. Upon further discussion, it became clear that substance is not ready to go yet in the state. The Department of Agriculture, the Oregon State Police need to work together in a task force type situation to see if that's even an option to pursue here in Oregon. And so we deleted the immunity provisions and simply asked that the Department of Agriculture and the State Police set up those task forces and study the effectiveness and sort of the cost analysis, bang for your buck type thing, to see if that's something that we should even be pursuing in the state. The last thing we did on the drug courts piece is we cleaned up that section quite a bit and made it a much more generalized section so that the Criminal Justice Commission will be responsible for administering grants for the drug courts, but it gives them a little bit more rulemaking authority instead of micromanaging via statute how the grants are going to be established. We also removed entirely the requirement that the local public safety coordinating councils would be the entity that applied for grants. It came to our attention that what actually occurs in counties is a drug court team gets set up, and so it's certainly more appropriate to have the drug court team be the ones who apply for those grants from the Criminal Justice Commission. And those are the major changes.
Well done, Heidi. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wong.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions of Ms. Mollett before we get started about her rendition of the amendments. First of all, I need to make sure that all of the minor changes she spoke about are in both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4.
Senator Walker, that is correct. The only difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 is the pseudoephedrine regulation.
Okay. And then my second question, Mr. Chair, is I don't remember because we have two bills here and we had many hearings. I can't remember which bill the food stamp issue was in. Is that in this one or is that in the one that's on our side of the building?
Senator Walker, the food stamp issue is here in House Bill 2485.
And did we address the concerns that were raised about that?
Senator Walker, the Department of Human Services submitted to us a set of proposed amendments. However, the work group, in examining the set of amendments that DHS had provided us with against the Dash 2 amendments, determined that the Dash 2 amendments, and therefore what's included in 3 and 4, was more reflective of the work group's concerns. And here was the primary difference. Both the amendments that you have before you and the Department of Human Services amendments were in compliance with federal law and with the regulations that the federal government already has in place. So we're not doing anything more in any of these amendments than there is already authority to do under federal law. The difference between what the Department of Human Services submitted to us and what's in the bill is that the Department of Human Services piece did not require the probation officer and department to take into account any children that might be in the home or dependents relying on the food stamps as well. Our amendments do that and do require children to be considered, and so the work group decided that that was a policy that they wanted incorporated in these amendments.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Is this the only list we've got?
Yes.
Sign up
here. These three coming up at once. These three coming up at once. And then I have the long.
Okay. And I Jim Anderson, Dr. Maxke, and Dr. Wasson. Please state your names, and you can start in any order you so wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Anderson, here today with Sharing Plow Corporation. With me today, as you had announced on my far right, is Dr. Stephen Hermansky. He is a doctor of pharmacy and has a PhD in drug safety. He is here also with Sharing Plow. To my immediate right is Dr. Suman Wasson. He is Senior Director of Global Medical Affairs, Wyeth Consumer Healthcare. With your permission, Mr. Vice Chair, we begin with Dr. Wasson.
Please do.
Good morning. You've all received my written testimony. My name, as Jim mentioned, is Suman Wasson, and I'm a physician with Wyeth Consumer Healthcare. We make and sell cold and allergy products that contain pseudoephedrine. We make everything. We make single-entity products. We make combination products. We make liquids. We make solids. And we make liquid gels. In fact, you'll recognize our products by the brand names Advil Cold and Sinus, for example, Dimetapp, and Robitussin. We acknowledge the serious methamphetamine problem that is plaguing Oregon at this time. You have acknowledged, indeed, that the imports and super labs are the primary and main cause of this problem. Of the cold and allergy products, the single-entity pseudo solid tablet is cheap and easy to convert to meth. We agree with you that this form of pseudoephedrine should be severely restricted. Liquids, liquid gels, and combination products are expensive and yield much less meth. We certainly support the Dash 4 amendment that allows, but are concerned about consumers in rural areas and low-income Oregonians who may not have access to these products because if they're in a situation where there is no pharmacy. We also believe that the prescription-only status would be too restrictive, again, denying access for these individuals. We believe that your current law, as promulgated by the Board of Pharmacy, has been working, and we would urge you to consider giving the Board of Pharmacy the authority to further restrict products if the situation demands it. I thank you for your time.
Who's next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Hermansky. I'm the Director of Product Safety and Performance for Sharing Plow Healthcare Products, makers of the products Claritin D and Drexoral, which contain pseudoephedrine. I appreciate the opportunity you are affording us to come to this committee and present our information associated with this bill. As Dr. Wasson said, you have my written testimony, and I plan to summarize the comments to expedite these hearings. Sharing Plow supports all efforts to reduce the access and use of any of our products in the manufacture of illicit drugs, including pseudoephedrine-containing products. However, we consider it to be very important to maintain appropriate access to these important medicines to the people of the state of Oregon who suffer from colds and allergies. Millions of consumers rely upon these products to control their symptoms and stay protected stay productive members of society, whether that be in work or at school. No current phenylephrine products allows for once or twice a day dosing, but must be taken every 4 hours. Furthermore, no current phenylephrine product are combined with non-sedating antihistamines, such as with Claritin D. The DEA data that we have access to through the El Paso Intelligence Center, or EPIC, indicates that the combination extended-release products are not used frequently in meth laboratories. In fact, during the years of 2000 through 2004, with over 63,000 busts of meth labs across the United States that were reported to EPIC, only 73 contained a Shearing Plow product, which is the only data we have access to. In the state of Oregon, importantly, none of those busts contained a Shearing Plow product. Reasons for this are fairly obvious. These products are very expensive to buy. They are not efficient to use in producing pure methamphetamine. It is more difficult to produce pure methamphetamine using these products, and we have theft deterrent processes in place. Importantly, the current actions in the state of Oregon to move these products behind the pharmacy counter have, by your own admission, been very successful in decreasing meth lab busts in the state of Oregon. Now taking the additional step to make pseudoephedrine products Schedule III prescription products have numerous ramifications in the state of Oregon. First, availability to those law-abiding citizens will be significantly reduced. Cost to consumers and Oregon's healthcare system will be increased. The ability to treat cold and allergies will be, the timing to be able to treat those will oftentimes be reduced. You'll have to use four-hour tablets. You'll have to take a tablet every 4 hours. Economic hardships will be most significant for the most vulnerable Oregonians, those at the lower end of our economic scale. The additional impact of moving these products behind the pharmacy counter of meth availability will be minimal and of questionable value to further reducing meth labs in Oregon. Because of this information, Shearing Plow supports your efforts, and we support the current status of pseudoephedrine being sold from behind the prescription counter, being sold, and believe that moving these products to prescription status is inappropriate use of your government powers. We support Dash 4, and we oppose Dash 3 amendments.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I'm not sure which one of you cares to answer this question, but I want to ask this because I think we're kind of missing the boat here. We're trying to get it at the back end after the product's already been distributed rather than the front end. So let me ask this question. Where your product is manufactured, your large factories, when you ship it out, do you track or register where you are making those shipments, or does the federal government require you to do that?
Actually, I'm not aware of the situation at our company, but I can certainly get back with that information for you. Do you?
I would have to get back with you on that information as well. I think it's important to note that each of our products have electronic sensors, so that when they're tracked through and they're prevented to be stolen from products, from stores that contain the electronic sensor, they look like metal detectors in the stores, and 80% of our shipments of all of our products go to stores that contain those electronic sensing devices.
Mr. Chair, can I do a follow-up? Thank you, John. And I guess I do need the answer to that question because, first of all, I didn't know you. Well, I knew that because of your testimony that you had the electronic sensors on there. Are you unusual in a pharmaceutical company to do that?
Let me respond for Wyeth. Certain of our products that have a tendency for theft do have these source tags, as we refer to them. Our entire line does not.
Okay. And then my final follow-up question, Mr. Chair. If you find out your company doesn't have a registry of where you're shipping these products, because as we know from the testimony, the numerous hours of testimony we have received on these bills, that only a small percentage is the home labs, and the greater percentage is coming from the mega super labs, which the Mexican cartel tends to predominantly push those things. Would you be opposed to registering where your products go so that we could track those large purchases of product?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I may have misunderstood your first question. Now that you've clarified that a little bit, I'm not aware of federal or state requirements requiring a registration, but every one of our shipments is monitored and we know where they are going. We also monitor each one of our shipments, and anytime there's a suspicious order, we question that order and don't ship until we can verify where it's going. So at our plant, we have those processes in place now.
Okay. That's getting to the heart of the question that I had, Mr. Okay. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Committee members, have any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I'll direct this to the panel, and you can decide who would respond. In the Dash 3 amendments, the Section 3A under Section 11 of the bill would prescribe a Schedule 3 designation, and the last sentence of that 3A, it happens to be on the top of page 9 in the Dash 3, says the Schedule 3 classification may be modified by the State Board of Pharmacy if the Board of Pharmacy finds that restrictions on products containing, and it lists the products, do not significantly reduce the number of methamphetamine laboratories within the state. And I want to get your comment on whether whether that's an unworkable standard to say we're going to go measure level 3 or Schedule 3 restriction that is requiring a prescription for access, but that could be reversed by the Board of Pharmacy without a statutory change if the Board of Pharmacy finds that it doesn't have the positive effects that we're looking to achieve.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, let me take the first stab at that. I would question, we noticed that this morning, and thank you to committee staff. We got these amendments, I think, just about the same time you did, sometime late yesterday. Albeit to say, that section that you just mentioned does raise some question in our mind. Does the Board of Pharmacy act on their own volition in that regard? What would be the catalyst that would make them do the investigative work that they would need to do to find out that indeed that standard has been met? Does law enforcement come before them? Does the healthcare medical community come before them to bring the statistics that they may have? I question, quite honestly, if law enforcement would be encouraged to do that, seeing as they have a strict standard in place. If indeed the committee does pass the Dash 3 amendments and put the pseudoephedrine product under Schedule 3, what would be their incentive? They have the most strict standard they could possibly imagine. Why would they want to give the Board of Pharmacy the ability to reverse that? I think that portion does raise a lot of questions, and those questions need to be answered before the committee can ever consider passing Schedule 3 and Dash 3 amendments.
As I indicated, we also support that the pharmacy board should have the flexibility in the other direction. In other words, if time shows that the situation is changing and these products are being abused, that they be restricted.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. To comment on my interpretation of the language, it gives the Board of Pharmacy the latitude to go either way, Schedule 3 or lower, but the key difference between the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s is that Schedule 3 is what we start out with unless an affirmative finding is made. And in response to your comment, Mr. Anderson, my expectation would be that those who would like to have the product more available, and that would probably mean your clients, would then have the burden of demonstration. They would have to gather the data that would prove that this finding could be made and then present it to the Board of Pharmacy and would be accessing then law enforcement records in order to make that kind of showing. Any
Mr. Chair,
comment on that, that would be fine.
Representative McPherson, I'm not sure how we would do that in the state of Oregon since our products are not currently being used in meth labs. So if that we have documented evidence of. So if we already don't have any use and you pass this bill and you want to show a negative from a negative, it would be difficult for me to show any positive movement from that perspective. Perhaps there'll be testimony presented today that we don't have access to that will indicate that there is a verifiable number of times that the combination extended release type of products are being used, but we're not aware of that from the EPIC database, which is the information that we consider to be verifiable DEA information.
Just to follow up on, I mean, the standard is whether the Schedule 3 designation does not significantly reduce the number of meth labs within the state, and not as to whether particular products are being used. So I think that the data that's already being used, and I think you folks have brought forward about the reduction in the number of labs as a result of the restrictions applied by the Pharmacy Board last year, that same kind of information could be presented then to make a finding with respect to that point.
Mr. Chair, Senator McPherson, or Representative McPherson, my apologies.
I appreciate the promotion.
we absolutely would like to talk through that additionally, but there's always a lumping of products that occurs, a lumping of data that occurs that oftentimes confuses the issues. So for us, it's important that we be able to be in a situation where we can actually utilize data effectively to do that. So we would be interested in further discussing that. But to us, my interpretation of that was a fairly unusable perspective for my company.
No.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson again. I would follow up on Dr. Hermansky just to maybe raise another point with Representative McPherson. If we extend your line of thinking with that language, and I'm having a little trouble with that language myself, I wonder then if we could bring, and the burden of proof does fall on the pharmaceutical company, could we then extend that logical thinking to say, if this is indeed the will of the legislature to put this under Schedule 3 initially, and then we petition the Board of Pharmacy and have proof, positive, showing out through history that maybe they could take us off all schedules altogether and eventually move us behind the counter where we believe we should be in the first place.
I think that's all I had.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes.
Jennifer Fox and Liz Holchin. Might be close. Name and everyone wants to start.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jennifer Hawks, and I represent the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. It's an association of manufacturers of over-the-counter medicines, including the men you just heard testimony from. We are here today because you are considering two different amendments, and I'd like to speak to Amendment Number 3, which would place pseudoephedrine and ephedrine products on Schedule 3 prescription status. Recently, Northwestern University released a study that shows cough cold medicines save the U.S. economy over $5 billion a year. And these medicines are available over the counter because they're effective, they're cost effective, and they treat what people need to be treated. And people don't have to go to a doctor. They can go to a pharmacy or to a grocery or sometimes to a convenience store or an airport gift shop and pick up what they need to treat their colds while they're sick. Oregon has already taken very extensive steps and some very great measures in order to improve the situation that you face in fighting clandestine meth labs. And of those steps you've taken, right now, all solid dose pseudoephedrine products are behind a pharmacy counter, so that a consumer must go to a pharmacist and ask for the medicine. They must show an identification, and they must sign a log of each sale. By placing pseudoephedrine and ephedrine on Schedule 3, that would require a doctor visit, and it would increase the cost of, say, a $6 box of medicine would all of a sudden turn into an $85 box of medicine, because that consumer would then have to go to a doctor, pay a doctor visit, then go and have a prescription filled at a pharmacy. Now, if a person has insurance, then their insurance cover, it may cover the doctor visit, and it may or may not cover a prescription. So those people might not be as greatly impacted as the, I believe you have 55% of working uninsured here in Oregon. Those people would not be able to then buy that $6 box of medicine. They would be out of pocket, in addition, out of the time from work to go to the doctor. And that's if they could afford to go to the doctor in the first place, which would be unlikely. Another consideration is in ephedrine. If you put ephedrine, it's currently written on Schedule 3, you take the only two, there are only two medicines available today over the counter for asthma attacks. Those would become prescription. So someone suffering from an asthma attack that needed immediate relief would no longer be able to get that medicine and would have to go to an emergency room for treatment. And I've heard testimony in other states that these medicines do prevent emergency room visits and doctor visits for asthmatics. And that is clearly a very serious implication. Currently, putting medicine on Schedule 3 prescription status would very likely have little advantage over placing these medicines behind a pharmacy counter, requiring a pharmacist to consult the sale and obtain information from the purchaser. The vast majority of consumers use these medicines as they are intended. We have a cold, we have allergies, we have seasonal sinus problems, and we go buy medicine that we need. When you have it such that it's a prescription, it decreases the access, obviously, to consumers. In addition, it makes it much more difficult for consumers to get products they need when they need them, and it doesn't, I don't think, give the state that much more information than it already would be getting from people under the current regulations. And so I would like to make those comments, and I invite any questions at the appropriate time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Lise Houchin. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. Just to name a couple of the companies in Oregon that includes, it's Albertsons, Costco, Fred Meyer, Hagen's, High School, Kmart, Long's, Medicap, Medicine Shop, Rite Aid, Safeco, Shopco, Safeway, Shopco, Target, Walmart, Walgreens. Okay, now that we've got all that out of the way. I want to compliment this committee and the Senate committee on all their hard work on these bills. I know it's a very difficult task in working on this issue in nine states. I know under what you labor, so I have a great deal of sympathy for all the time and energy that you have put in and a lot of respect for you for working on this. Our members are very aware and very sensitive to the negative ramifications of methamphetamine labs and their impact on our local communities. As a result of their concern, most community pharmacies, chains, and independents have taken additional steps above current law and rule to restrict sales. As we've worked through this process, one thing seems to have been made painfully clear, and that's the fact that the Oregon State Police have suffered a severe setback as a result of budget cuts over the last 4 years. We would encourage this legislature to increase funding for the state police so that they have the money they need to go after the small meth labs. Unfortunately, this will do nothing to address the fact that the majority of the product coming into Oregon is coming from Canada and Mexico and via the Internet, but at least it will give them the tools that they need to do the job that they're trying to do. In addition, one of the things that we would like to comment on is why not look at implementing sales restrictions on wholesalers to get at the single entity wholesalers that in most cases are providing this product at the local level. In Washington, in the past year, we were able to close down over 40 illegitimate wholesalers with legislation that was enacted in 2004. And the manufacturers and the retailers worked very hard with the legislature to help enact that legislation. As an industry, we are committed to helping solve this problem. One of the comments I'd like to make is on dash 3. In section, I can do this. I've got a question and then a comment. In Section 11, the section you were discussing in 3A, when you talked about giving the Board of Pharmacy the flexibility to go from Schedule 3 perhaps to even Schedule 5, one of the things that I'm a little concerned about is in line 3, it's very clear that they may not exempt any products. And if you really want to give them flexibility, that might be something you want to look at. Not denying them the ability to exempt products that aren't being used, which gets to Jennifer's point about access. The other section I wanted to comment on very quickly is Section 13. I'm concerned between Subsection 2 and Subsection 3. In Subsection 2, you talk about the record keeping for pharmacy and the person who sells or transfers the product. By making this product a Schedule 3, transaction records will have to be kept. That's current statute and regulation. So I would appreciate the consideration of having Section 2 reflecting Section 3 with the flexibility, acknowledging the fact that those records are already being kept. The other thing, and this comes from some work that we're doing in Washington, because of the current record-keeping requirements in Oregon, we would ask that either the Board of Pharmacy and or the state police be required to pick up the records when they need them, as opposed to having our folks have to transcend them whenever there's a request. If that's something you'd be willing to consider, we would appreciate it. The members of NACDS, although supportive of most state solutions to the problem, feel at this point our focus should be at the federal level to enact a nationwide solution to this horrific problem. NACDS has been out front supporting bipartisan legislation in the U.S. Senate that would enact universal sales restrictions, allowing those companies operating in multiple states a consistency by which they can operate. And we look forward to continuing working with you in the legislature. Thank you very much.
Committee members. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, on behalf of the Senate contingency here today, I want to express my appreciation for your including us in your hearing today. My question is for Ms. Hawks-Bland. You talk about the research at Northwestern University that concluded that these over-the-counter medicines save the economy $5 billion a year. Were the alternatives to pseudoephedrine included in this study?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, this study can encompass the entire over-the-counter cough cold category, and it encompassed lost wages, time doctor visits, and expenses. And currently, I think you're talking about phenylephrine as an alternative to pseudoephedrine. Currently, phenylephrine is a product that's already available on the market and has been available since the late 1940s. So clearly, that is on the market, so it would have been included in the study.
So these savings were not specific to pseudoephedrine. These savings did include the alternatives.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, ma'am. It did include alternatives, and it included the whole cough cold category, which the vast majority of cold medicines have pseudoephedrine in them.
Because there are studies on the other side of this issue as well, where people have actually analyzed the tremendous cost of the meth epidemic on the communities. I think the statistics from Portland were something like $385 per household. I'm trying to conjure this up in my brain. So with alternatives available, is there any way of really concluding that the lack of availability of pseudoephedrine would have any impact whatsoever on these savings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, because this study is a nationwide study, it does take into effect the alternatives that are out there, and it clearly considers all the factors that go into healthcare savings. These savings would not, if in fact cough cold medicines are not available widely to people, they are going to miss time off work, or they are going to be spending time at the doctor's office, and the cost to the healthcare system would increase, thereby decreasing these cost savings. And I'll be happy to provide the committee and Senator Burdick with a copy of the abstract from the study if you wish.
That would be helpful, but I guess my point is that with alternatives available that deal with the same symptoms, you know, how can you argue that you have to have pseudoephedrine to achieve these savings?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, clearly pseudoephedrine is an important part of the healthcare system, and alternatives, phenylephrine in this case, are not currently widely available. So they may be in the future, and I know companies are looking to reformulate and are considering that, to reformulate products to phenylephrine and other alternatives, but that's not there yet. And to put medicine on prescription status before that is a reality would severely impact the healthcare system here in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, just one more question if I could. You mentioned the impact on asthma sufferers. Asthma is a life-threatening disease. Wouldn't it be fair to say that asthma sufferers already have a relationship with a doctor because of their disease, and it really would not be that much of a stretch to get a phone prescription for an asthmatic?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I do agree that most asthmatics already have doctor-patient relationships established, and I can relate to you testimony of the Board of Pharmacy Executive Director in New Mexico, and because New Mexico considered doing new restrictions on ephedrine this past summer, and he said that he had been saved a trip to the emergency room more than once, and he is an asthmatic with a doctor-patient relationship, but maybe he was out of his medicine and he needed an over-the-counter medicine, and he needed it quickly, and he was able to get it in an efficient manner, and he saved himself a trip to the hospital.
Walker. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on a couple of questions by Senator Burdick, you may have that relationship with your doctor, but I think, Ms. Hawks, you indicated airport gift shops. That did not occur to me until you spoke about that, and I have been on an airplane because they're horrible places to be because everybody's sick and it's recycled air and you come off and suddenly you've got this horrible cold and you can't breathe. So you head for the gift shop to get your drugs because you don't pack them in your carry-on thinking you're going to get sick. And with this, if we implemented this, well, if you're in an airport in Oregon, you would no longer be able to get it at a gift shop. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, you are correct. And in fact, those who are visiting here in Oregon and taking part of your tourism industry would no longer have access to decongestant medicines while they are here unless they have to go to a doctor that's out of their plan or can find an emergency room. But I have responsibility for all 50 states, and I travel about 100,000 miles a year. And so I, too, am familiar with the airport gift shops for sinus medicine.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, can I follow up? I've been on a tour of the Pfizer lab in La Jolla, I think it is. And so I got some instruction on how long it takes to manufacture a drug from the creative thinking mind to the end, getting FDA approval. And that's a very long period of time, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, it is. And it can take up to 2 to 3 years to get, in this case, if we were talking about reformulation of a product that needed FDA approval, it could take 2 to 3 years to go through the process.
But it takes about 15 years to develop a drug.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, I have one question for our other guest, if I might. She mentioned the Ms. Houchen, is that your last name?
Houchen, yes.
Houchen. You mentioned Washington State law, and I actually did look into that and gave that to our committee counsel to review, and I have a copy of it here. And it did reduce the number of distributors in Washington State because it put some requirements on the wholesale distributors. But when I posed that question to committee counsel, her answer back to me was, after reviewing the Washington statute, I contacted Rob Bovet and Craig Durbin since they go to so many regional meetings on the meth issue. And Rob responded below, and I'll read that to you. And Rob also mentioned that there would need to be an increase in regulators in Washington. The state patrol got more troopers. Such a concept that Oregon might get more troopers. But Mr. Bovet's comment was, Washington has had some success in weeding out rogue wholesale distributors of PSE, and they had plenty to weed out. I don't think we've ever had anything close to that degree of problem here in Oregon, so I would view this as very little return on investment here in Oregon. Washington has also not had a significant decrease in the incidence of local meth labs. Only Oklahoma and Oregon can make that claim, and then provided me a report that I read. Could you please respond to that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, I can. First of all, I'll start at the end and work my way back. Yes, we have seen a significant reduction in meth labs in Washington State as a result of a number of pieces of legislation that a lot of people in this room have worked very hard to implement and to get passed, and that includes the drug manufacturers as well as the retailers. So we have had a significant decrease by virtue of what we've been doing. My understanding, and Mr. Rice is here from the chairman of the Board of Pharmacy. My understanding in Oregon, and I believe this is correct, is they don't currently license the wholesalers. And therein lies the difference. In Washington, we do. And so, therefore, it made sense for us to work with these wholesalers. And we were also aware of the fact that they were single-entity wholesalers. So basically, all they were doing was buying pseudoephedrine products for basically to turn around and sell them to folks who were selling them for the manufacture of methamphetamine. And those, and as I referred to my, because I'm sure there's a better word for it, but we call them the illegitimate wholesalers, because that was their sole purpose for having a license, was to be able to sell these single-entity products. So we have had a significant reduction. I don't know what your wholesale situation looks like, but primarily I don't know that because they aren't currently licensed.
Those are really good answers to my questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, ladies.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the significant reduction over there? How many labs were there? How many are there now?
I would have to get back to you with that information. We just, and I should know this off the top of my head, and I apologize. We just had numerous hearings in Washington on this in the last couple months, and I know it, and it's not coming to me. I apologize.
Thank you.
We do have a witness coming up in the next panel who works with the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab, and so perhaps she, maybe not, but perhaps she has some thoughts on that.
Thank you. Do you have any comments on any part of what you've heard so far?
Well, two things. I actually had a question from Ms. Hawks-Bland to start. You mentioned that if we do this Schedule 3, that there will be no decongestants on the shelves available at the airplane gift shops, but isn't phenylephrine a decongestant?
It is.
Okay. So phenylephrine products that would remain out on the shelves would be in things like airport gift shops, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And then as to the Section 13 comment that Ms. Houchin made, I just wanted to alert the committee that the reason that Section 13 is written the way that it is, as you can see in Section 12, we're giving the State Board of Pharmacy until July 1st of 2006 to enact all of the rules that the Dash 3 amendments direct them to enact, including that Schedule 3 designation. Because of the sort of rulemaking procedures, we needed to give them that kind of time to accomplish that. Hopefully they can get it done more quickly. But in any event, Section 13, you'll see, says, for the period of time beginning on the effective date of this act and ending on the date the rules required by ORS 475973 sub 3 become operative, this remains in effect. The logging portion remains in effect. And so that is why that is in here. And once the Schedule 3 designation goes into effect, this logging piece in Section 13 will no longer be required, unless and until the Board of Pharmacy decides to maybe go to Schedule 5. So that was the reason for that particular language remaining in here.
Just one quick comment. As a chronic allergy sufferer, phenylephrine doesn't work well for me. I prefer, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, I prefer pseudoephedrine-containing products. And to allow consumer choice, striking a balance with the safety of our state, I think is, we need to look at that, not just do a blanket, assume that, force people to go to one product, because I think I would probably just start ordering over the internet.
You get over the internet, we might have to get to that too, I guess. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Have Craig Durbin, Rob Bovette, and Laurie Crops come up, please. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to chat with you about some of the stuff we've just heard. For the record, my name is Rob Ovette, legal counsel for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. I will keep my comments very short. However, I do need to start by saying that I heard a lot of what I can only characterize as misinformation or disinformation, some of which I'd like to clarify or explain. We also have some additional information that I'll let Craig and our guests from the Washington State Patrol share with you about the latest data and information. I was going to focus primarily on just a couple of quick comments about liquids and gels, but you might as well expand that to combo products, as we've heard some, as far as I'm concerned, misinformation about that as well. One of the primary foundations of what we heard from the first panel was that, boy, the meth cooks have a hard time getting the pseudoephedrine out of these combo liquids and gels such that they can't make good quality meth. Well, that's just wrong. There's no other way to say it. That's just wrong. That's not been the experience on the street for quite some time. I understand, you know, Craig and I were, you know, in Ohio all last week, and I understand that you guys were all presented, or many of you were presented, with this study from McNeil Laboratories, which would tend on its face to justify that conclusion and substantiate that conclusion. And so we want to talk about the McNeil study as well as a couple other studies. And I've provided you in the written testimony with the DEA gave us special permission to release this a little bit early. This is a three-page summary of their study on this exact issue that we can talk about. And that's the study that I think was bantered around the Capitol building all last week. It's very unfortunate that was. I think through the three of us, you're going to hear the rest of the story, because there's more to this story from McNeil Laboratories than meets the eye. I'm not going to bore you with all this stuff. I'm going to skip all past. You guys have all seen my all fancy meth lab stuff. As soon as we got back and we got this and we heard this was being circulated around, you know, Craig and I read this, we popped it open to the conclusion. They basically were saying, well, they're getting gunk out of the combo products, extended products, the liquids and the gels. And we said, wow, we know that's not true. We got stats showing a majority of the meth labs in the state of Oregon use the combo products, extended products, and now we're seeing the liquids and the gels. So how is this making sense? Well, we went back and started to look at it, made a lot of phone calls, and the bottom line is, and I'll let Craig and Lori talk about this in detail, they basically used the wrong process to extract the pseudoephedrine. McNeil did. They used a kind of a relatively old formula that some meth cooks can still use for the single ingredient product. But to kind of boil it down to its essence, these are the two chemicals they used to extract the pseudoephedrine from those products, alcohol and acetone. And when I saw that, I said, wow, why were they doing that? I shouldn't have been doing that, because that's not what our meth cooks use. That's not what they know to use on these products. I have them for quite some time. I'll show you the products they probably should have used, and they'll talk about the results you get when you use the correct products to extract the pseudoephedrine. Different solvent here, another common one. And you'll like this one. You don't use alcohol. That's a real tough solvent to find. You use water. That's what you have to use to get the pseudoephedrine out of the liquids and the gels, and in certain cases, combination products. Those are the two studies that we have for you today. Craig's going to talk about the brand new DEA study. The short story is that after McNeil did this work, they went to the DEA and said, hey, look what we got. You know, this is looking like you guys ought to be backing off of the combos and the liquids and the gels. And the DEA got together with McNeil and two other pharmaceuticals and said, well, this is wrong. You used the wrong process. You used the wrong solvents. So they did the analysis with McNeil and these other pharmaceuticals, and I don't know if it would surprise you to know that McNeil no longer takes the position they took in this paper that you were all handed last week and haven't for quite some time. They believe that all pseudoephedrine products should be treated the same, much like Pfizer and a few of the other major pharmaceuticals, and they parted ways, parted company with CHIPA on that issue. So my question of you on the bottom of just our short, brief, written supplement to our testimony is, I wonder if when you were handed this study, you were told the rest of that story. I kind of doubt it, but I think it's important that you know the rest of that story. I'm going to turn it over to these guys to get into the details, but I would love to answer any questions that possibly could remain from some of the other, which in my opinion are misstatements that you heard throughout the first part of this morning. But I'll leave you with this. Let's say loud and clear in Oregon, we will do everything in our power to ensure that no more drug-endangered children are pulled from the toxic hell of a meth lab environment. Please, please, please pass the Dash 3 amendments into this bill, and let's stay ahead of this curve.
Mr. Bovet, your slide said Dash 4, but you...
Dash 3.
Dash 3,
sorry.
Thanks.
Typing fast last night.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I'm a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and currently the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. And back in Ohio, I can just tell you that Oregon was applauded for what we're considering, what we're doing, and where we're going. And we are on the forefront of meth legislation, I can tell you that. And we're being looked at. We're being looked at by all these other states, and they're wanting to know what we're going to do. And we also learned, and we showed you, and we had Mr. Gearhart here talking about that National Jewish Meth Study. They're doing some other studies, and it's getting worse. We're finding out that now they've done two-day cooks in environments, and they're finding out what the residual are in those environments, and it is very bad. So any lab that we have out here is for children, for your constituents, for any of those people, it's going to be very, very bad. What we learned from the temporary rule that was in place and from the Board of Pharmacy rule, and what we've learned in the last 8 months is really good information. Things are developing very rapidly. In the temporary rule, and Rob and I argued before the Board of Pharmacy, and we've mentioned it here, that all pseudoephedrine products need to be treated the same, and that you have to have what we have right now in our legislation, you have to have the pieces of the Oklahoma legislation in order to be effective. You have to have it behind pharmacy counters. You have to have some kind of log, and I think going to the Schedule 3 to where we don't even have to worry about the log is the best way, but they all need to be treated the same. And under the temporary rule, we were disheartened initially because they left the combo products out at the convenience store. And you've heard today about single entity, single entity, single entity keeps being bannered around. And we've always said that it's no difference between the multi-ingredient and single entity at the time of this rule, and we weren't concerned with gel caps and liquids because they weren't not being used at that time. The industry always held that just worry about the single entity, and that's been since around 1980s all the way up until present. But what we do know is the vast majority of labs that are turned into our crime lab and to El Paso Intelligence Center, and I appreciate Mr. Hermansky's testimony about that the shearing plow products, only 73 of the products are found, that may be the case. But the vast majority of the products that are being used in these labs are multi-ingredient products. That is confirmed by our lab, and it's also confirmed by the El Paso Intelligence Center. This is one of the sheets that I had them pull up to look at that, and they said, in fact, it's multi-ingredients that are being used in the lab. And if you look at the right-hand side, it shows the products that were being found in those labs. The other thing that we learned was behind the counter. What happens when it's behind the counter of convenience stores, and that it should be just left out there and available, that the convenience store should be able to sell the combo products out there and just lock up the single ingredients behind the pharmacies. Well, Portland Police Bureau, and Sergeant Schober's here today, Portland Police Bureau Drugs and Vice Division was on record pace last year for their labs that they were being found. In November, what happened was our temporary rule went into place, and basically the bottom dropped out of the labs that they were being found. It was amazing. They said it was just unbelievable that the labs that they were not finding, even the patrol was not finding labs in cars, until March. In March, the labs started to go back up. Now, we were just a few months into our temporary rule. Why did that happen? Well, they were able to develop an informant. And what this informant told them was is that they found out after going to convenience stores, number one, that the convenience stores would not really scrutinize their ID, didn't really check out their ID. If they did ask for ID, then they didn't even really take it from them. And then the last thing was is that they found out there was not a log. And being as there was not a log, they were not concerned about being tracked. So what did they do? They all jumped in cars. They started going down 82nd, 122nd, continuing their Smurfer runs from the convenience stores because they were not concerned about the rule. And the lab started to go back up. So we wanted to confirm this. Was this in fact true? And I sent out people from my office and had them do controlled buys in the valley area and on the eastern side of Oregon, had them do equal amount of buys and asked them to check and find out if they were asking for the ID and complying with the temporary rule. What we found was a 40% compliance with the convenience stores and a 90% compliance with the pharmacies. Now, there's over 2,000 stores right now licensed, convenience stores, to sell pseudoephedrine products by the Board of Pharmacy. There's under 800, and there's around 750, 760 pharmacies. a significant number less to actually regulate and look at and control where the pseudoephedrine is being sold. There's only 6 Board of Pharmacy inspectors for all those stores. So if you leave any pseudoephedrine products out at convenience stores, it's an unmanageable task. Are they going to be able to really check and make sure that the convenience store operators are selling what they should be selling? Because right now, DEA only that looks at wholesalers about every 3 years on a cyclic rotation. They do not check how much is going to a particular convenience store unless they're asked to and there's a case that's initiated. So to check what's coming in the back door and what's going out the front door is literally impossible unless you have wholesale regulations, and then you're still relying on the convenience stores to do the right thing, which we've shown that that's difficult. The other thing is that all the diversion cases initiated within the last couple of years by either DEA or law enforcement, which means illegitimate sales, have been on convenience stores in Oregon, not on pharmacies. The next thing, while we were talking about all pseudoephedrine products being treated the same, now we believe gel caps and liquids should be as well. And we've already mentioned this. Oregon was the first to find a gel cap lab. That sample was sent to the state crime lab. In fact, they found pseudoephedrine in that sample. You're going to hear from WSP today about the ease of making methamphetamine from gel caps. It's now been confirmed by DEA, and word is out on the street. Liquids. We just had, in April, the first liquid lab seized in the nation. Again, Oregon. And this cook has been around since the 70s because he talked about prop dope and making prop dope. So he is very well versed in how to cook methamphetamine. And it didn't take him very long to figure it out. And in fact, it was interesting. I had a recording of this, and I'd be glad to show you at some point. But he talked about being so tired while he was cooking his methamphetamine, he threw the first reaction out the back door because he didn't want it to get away from him. He has also had multiple people waiting outside his room to get the methamphetamine as soon as he cooked it. The methamphetamine that he sold was made through Vicks Formula 44D, cough and cold syrup. And he said it's the new thing out to make a meth with Vicks Formula 44D. That's right on the tape. These are the bottles he pointed out that should contain pseudoephedrine based on his reaction that he made with the Vicks Formula 44D. They were sent to our lab, and in fact, they were confirmed pseudoephedrine. Another issue that was brought up was the availability of products. And I thought it was really important to hit on this. We had a work group after the temporary rule with the Board of Pharmacy. And it was interesting to note that one of the industry members actually handed the list of cough and cold remedies to one of the pharmacists. That pharmacist started checking off what actually was going to be pulled off the shelf behind the counter when the rule went into place. What they found was that 52% of the cough and cold remedies were still available to the public after the pseudoephedrine products were pulled from the counter. Okay, so that's 52%. In your book we handed to you in Pendleton, you had a Resicar study that was commissioned by the DEA to look at what the legitimate sales of pseudoephedrine should be in the nation. What they said was that a quarter of the pseudoephedrine sales were actually legitimate sales. And that was confirmed by the industry. What we found on wholesale sales, since our rule confirms that study. So actually, the sales of pseudoephedrine should be a quarter of what it was. And now, you've got all these companies turning over to phenylephrine, replacing that product shelf space, that 48% that was taken away from pseudoephedrine. So a very small percentage of people in Oregon really need pseudoephedrine where phenylephrine will not work. And phenylephrine, even Sudafed now, is Sudafed PE. And we've included in your packet here an industry periodical that comes out, Drug Topics. And this just came out in June 6th. And it says, Pfizer, the company claims that Sudafed PE also provides temporary relief of sinus congestion. Bristol-Myers is reformulating its Comtrex family of products to phenylephrine. Lanier Health, the firm is introducing a slew of cough and cold and sinus products that contain phenylephrine. So they're all going over to phenylephrine. Rob already talked about this. McNeil got together after that study with DEA. They did further evaluation using this method. What they found, very high yield of pseudoephedrine out of liquid and gel caps. And then now position of Johnson & Johnson, and I got this from their rep, who is a parent company of McNeil Pharmaceuticals. And they said now you can convert directly to methamphetamine, that that February data was incomplete. They do favor placing all products, including gel caps and liquids, behind the pharmacy counter, and they do not oppose prescription only. So I think that we've learned a lot. We've learned a lot about gel caps and liquids. We've learned about that there is the product still available out there for people to get their relief, and we've learned that these cooks, if you leave these products out and available to them very quickly, they will start to continue in their labs. And thank you for your time.
Click the next one. Identify yourself and proceed, please.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Lori Knox. I work for the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory located in Marysville, Washington. I'm employed as a forensic scientist. A little bit about what I do there. I spend 50% of my time conducting analysis of controlled substances as well as analysis of samples submitted from clandestine laboratory labs. The other 50% of my time is spent conducting research funded by the National Institute of Justice on current and emerging trends in methamphetamine manufacture. I'm going to talk to you today about the research that we conducted within our laboratory titled Methamphetamine Manufacture from Cold and Allergy Medications Containing Pseudoephedrine in Multi-Ingredient Liquid and Soft Gel Preparations. I worked on this research with two other scientists, Dr. David Northrup and Dr. Eric Person. It came about when Dr. Northrup was approached by our crime lab director. He had heard from sources from across the country that these exemptions are being made for liquid and soft gel preparations of pseudoephedrine. And he asked if we could spend some time researching this to see if, in fact, we could make meth from pseudoephedrine extracted from these preparations. We took a little time off of the research that we were currently doing, and this was our focus. So the purpose of this study was to address the possible use of potentially exempt preparations in methamphetamine manufacturing. We chose five representative medications. We extracted and reduced them in a series of small-scale red phosphorus iodine cooks. Some of the preparations that we included were one multi-ingredient, one liquid medicine, two liquids, and one soft gel. And in fact, all of these are multi-ingredient. There are arguments raised for these exemptions of these preparations. One is that the techniques are not available for extracting the pseudoephedrine. Two, that there may be impurities present in the extracted pseudoephedrine that may inhibit its use in the manufacturing process. Third argument, that there is an inefficient recovery of the pseudoephedrine and that this will increase cost and time. Here are the five specifically that we chose. One is the coated caplets, which is the multi-ingredient. Two is liquid medicine, this is a generic of Theraflu. Three is a water-based cough syrup. Four would be an alcohol-based cough syrup. And five, liquid cap, soft gel, however you refer to those. My plan is to go over each extraction technique for each of these preparations, as well as go over the results of our extraction and if in fact it could be used to make methamphetamine. The first was the multi-ingredient coated caplet, generic equivalent of Sudafed severe cold. Each caplet contains acetaminophen, dextromethorphan, and pseudoephedrine. Our extraction procedure was to crush the caplets, soak in dilute acid, decant from the insolubles, basify, and extract twice with ethyl ether. Ethyl ether is what you see over here. It's in the form of starting fluid. I'm going to be showing you three pieces of data. I don't expect you to understand what exactly the data is, but I think that I can get my point across. I'm going to show you three pieces. A, B, and C is on the next slide coming up. These are gas chromatographs of data produced. The next slide will be data from the infrared spectrophotometer. A is the extracted material that was extracted from this preparation. B will be the result after exposing it to red phosphorus and iodine in a cook. So B is the cook sample. As you can tell, the coated caplets, the extracted material from the coated caplets, shown in A, contained, the first peak here is pseudoephedrine as well as dextromethorphan. After cooking with this extracted material, in 60 minutes we have complete conversion to methamphetamine. This piece of data shows the finished final salted methamphetamine hydrochloride product. This spectrum is essentially pure methamphetamine hydrochloride. If I were to compare this to a standard that I obtained from my drug standard drawer, that the spectrum would look essentially the same. All the peaks are there. This is methamphetamine hydrochloride. Second medication used was the hot liquid medicine, generic equivalent of Theraflu. Each packet is intended to be dissolved in hot water and drink. Each packet contains acetaminophen, chlorpheniramine, dextromethorphan, and pseudoephedrine. The extraction procedure was to dissolve a couple packets in water, hot water, basify, and extract three times into chloroform. The extracted material contained pseudoephedrine, chlorpheniramine, and dextromethorphan. In 60 minutes, we have conversion to methamphetamine, as well as chlorpheniramine, dextrophan, and a byproduct, phenyl-2-propanone, or P2P. This shows the spectrum of the finished methamphetamine hydrochloride product. Third medication was the water-based alcohol-free liquid, generic equivalent of Robitussin CF. Each dose contains guaifenesin, dextromethorphan, and pseudoephedrine. Our extraction procedure was to dilute in water, wash with starting fluid, basify the aqueous layer, and extract into chloroform. The extracted material contained pseudoephedrine, guaifenesin, and dextromethorphan. In 120 minutes, we have conversion to methamphetamine. And once again, the finished methamphetamine hydrochloride product. As you can see, all these spectrums look very similar. This is methamphetamine hydrochloride. Fourth preparation was the alcohol-based liquid. We used the brand name in this case. We used the Vicks NyQuil Multi-Symptom Cold Flu Relief. Each dose contained acetaminophen, doxylamine, dextromethorphan, and pseudoephedrine. Our extraction procedure was to dilute with water, basify, and extract with starting fluid. Our extracted material contained tarragon, pseudoephedrine, doxylamine, and dextromethorphan. In 60 minutes, we have conversion to methamphetamine, as well as we get a reduced doxylamine and dextrophan, which is a reduced dextromethorphan. Here is the spectrum of the finished methamphetamine hydrochloride product. And finally, we get to the liquid caps, or soft gels. We use generic of NyQuil liquid caps. Each soft gel contained acetaminophen, doxylamine, dextromethorphan, and pseudoephedrine. Our extraction procedure was to dissolve in hot water, pour that solution into denatured alcohol. We removed coagulated material, basified, and extracted into starting fluid. I have pictures of this. As you can see over here to the left, the first picture is of the soft gels dissolved in hot water. Shortly after, approximately 5 minutes, the outer shells dissolve. After pouring the second picture, this solution into alcohol, it results in a coagulated material, presumably the outer gelatin coating that was initially in the product. That material is removed, and that's what's basified and extracted. The extracted material contained pseudoephedrine, doxylamine, and dextromethorphan. In 59 minutes, we have conversion to methamphetamine, as well as the reduced doxylamine and dextrofan. Here's the picture of the finished methamphetamine hydrochloride product. So to conclude, each medication that we examined with appropriate sample preparation yielded a material or mixture of materials that permitted the conversion of pseudoephedrine to methamphetamine. So therefore, commercial preparations and multi-ingredient liquid and soft gel forms can be used in the manufacture of methamphetamine. And I do want to go back to address some questions that we had earlier, and I think Craig here touched on it a bit, on the percentage of multi-ingredient products seen in methamphetamine laboratories. Before I came here today, I looked at all of my reports, and I concluded that 88% of the time I see other ingredients in extracted material from pseudoephedrine, and with a very small amount being single-only products. So back to the arguments that I pointed out earlier, one, that the techniques are not available. Well, in fact, these techniques are available, and they are already in use. For example, to extract methamphetamine from the reaction material, you have to conduct a liquid-liquid extraction. In fact, that's what I've done here to extract the pseudoephedrine, is a liquid-liquid extraction. You basify and extract into a solvent. Secondly, that impurities will inhibit its use in the manufacture of methamphetamine, which I've shown here today that even though that in some cases, well, in most cases, the pseudoephedrine is also extracted with other materials such as antihistamines and cough suppressants, it does not inhibit its conversion to methamphetamine. Third, that this is an inefficient recovery process and that you will need more material to obtain the methamphetamine. In fact, cooks have been known to use inefficient processes in the past. For example, red phosphorus. You scrape thousands upon thousands of matchbooks to obtain the red phosphorus needed for these cooks. That is an inefficient process. This might take a split second longer. Instead of extracting into alcohol and waiting for your alcohol to dry down, you just add water, extract into a solvent, take the solvent off, and wait for it to dry down. It's one little step more in most cases. And what else do I want to say? I think that's all I have to say right now.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Knox. Are there any questions for anybody in the panel?
Yes.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Sickening. Absolutely sickening. Just so I'm clear on what the current law is, I guess not law, but the State Board of Pharmacy rule is, what single entity tablets are behind the counter right now?
Representative Thatcher, no, they are, but also the temporary rule was into place from November 15th till May, and that temporary rule placed single entity products behind pharmacies,
okay,
multi-ingredients behind convenience store counters, and then only required a flash of the ID. Since May, we've had a permanent rule where it's been a full, what we call the full Oklahoma, now the Oregon rule, where you have single and multi-ingredients behind pharmacy counters. Photo ID is required, and there's a log that requires the purchaser's names, the date of birth, the ID number, and the amount that's being purchased of the product. And then also there is a 9-gram 30-day limit in place.
And this is only for the hard caps, right?
Correct.
Not the gel caps or liquids.
Correct.
So currently the gel caps and liquids are just out on the shelves like anything else.
Okay. That's correct.
You said that the lab seizures went up. They went down for a while and they went up in March, I think you said. What was being used? Was it the caps that were kept behind the counters, or was it the off-the-shelf liquid? And What was being used?
The Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, the what was being used at that time was the multi-ingredients, what they were getting at the convenience stores, and that was just where we started to see the spike was right before all of it was pulled behind the pharmacy counter, because they were primarily going to the convenience stores and they were able to exploit that hole that was left open. Gel caps and liquids are a brand new phenomenon, and we had, as I explained, in Oregon, the first gel cap and the first liquid labs. And that information, and the reason that we were concerned about presenting this information, because we just put out exactly how to do it. However, the word is out on the street of how to do it. In fact, when we listen to the tape of this individual with the liquid extraction lab, he basically speaks to exactly what you just saw. So the word is out amongst our cooks now.
Can I add a quick comment? Just because we asked for the data, and I forgot to mention this before, we heard that Washington State has had a significant reduction in the incidence of meth labs, and I don't know what you define as significant. Oregon's had a 50%. I think that's significant. Oklahoma's had between 70 and 80% right now. I think that's significant. In Washington, state of Washington, 2003, they had 1,480 meth labs. 2004, they had 1,337 meth labs. By my calculations, and I don't have a calculator, that's somewhere between a 7 and an 8% reduction. I don't consider a 7% reduction in the incidence of meth labs to be significant, but maybe somebody else does.
Representative Parker. Thank you. Lieutenant, you said you want to put all these, if I understood you right, everything should be Schedule 3.
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker, that's correct. I think that Schedule 3, first of all, pseudoephedrine has been a Schedule 2 in Oregon, but there's been an exemption that's allowed it over the counters. When you look at the effects of pseudoephedrine, it actually fits as a Schedule 2 because of the side effects and those type of things. As a Schedule 3, it would be, from my understanding, you could phone in and ask for a prescription. You could get that prescription to obtain it. The other thing that it would do is it would relieve this whole burden of logs upon any of the pharmacies. It basically remove that, and it would also, at the same time, it would do exactly what we wanted to do with the logs in a more significant way, is that there would be even more scrutiny on the sales because it is a prescription. It's more tightly controlled. And what we know is absolutely effective is those logs. Those logs are the key, besides placing it behind the pharmacies where you can control it better. But the logs are the key because any other state that's tried just placing it either behind the counter or in a lock case or behind a pharmacy counter but never required a log, they have not had these reductions that Rob just mentioned. So I think by scheduling it, we take that extra step to make it even more, we remove any of that log and we're able to just control it through the prescriptions.
Can you follow up on that for me? Are there any other states that have this? That are doing their schedule.
Chair Krieger, Representative Barker, no. We would be the first, and again, last week when we talked, and we actually did a presentation before the National Meth Chemicals Initiative, and they were very encouraged by where we were going, and they were hoping that we would do this in order so that they would have some ability. In Oklahoma, when Oklahoma enacted what they enacted, I was being called, when once we had our temporary rule, I was being called from the drug czar's office and agencies across the nation, as well as Rob, waiting for the confirmation of our statistics and things that we could show. And in fact, we're the only state right now in the nation that are showing other statistics like wholesale sales of pseudoephedrine, iodine sales, cross-border sales, all those type of things that bolster the argument of why we need to do what we're doing. And so now they're looking at us, if we do this, to even show further that this works. And it's not about stopping the flow of methamphetamine into our state. It's about stopping the meth labs. And we've said over and over and over, that's what's hurting our ecology, that's what's hurting our constituents, that's what's hurting our children. And I can tell you, these task forces are telling me that it's absolutely incredible. They're able to seize more methamphetamine than they're ever able to do before and stop these drug trafficking organizations because they're not going from lab to lab to lab. And so it's really working.
Mr. Chair, and for the panel, a lot of information, thanks. I'm wondering if somehow you could kind of just give us a little bit better picture of the percentage of yield of product between that of hard tabs and that of the liquid and gels.
That would be DEA study.
That's a DEA. You can share. Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's actually attached in our written testimony, you'll see the yields from the DEA study that we're releasing actually for the first time today to you here. On the right-hand side, you'll see the percentage yields, which are pretty substantial, which are quite different than the 1 and 4% yields that was provided in the study that was mandated around this Capitol building last week. So they're extracting significant quantities of pseudoephedrine yields out of the liquids, the gels, and the combos if you do the process correctly. And when I say correctly, the process that the meth cooks in Oregon and Oklahoma and all around the nation know how to use.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, the studies that you did in the Washington State lab, those pretty much conform to this yield when you tested the various products? Or is this from your study?
Chair Krieger, Senator Burdick, we did not address any quantitative studies. We simply wanted to know if the material extracted converted to methamphetamine. We did no quantitative study.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Durbin, is there any capability for accumulating the information that would be put down in logs if we stay with a not Schedule 3, but we have people logging their individual sales? Is there any system for trying to accumulate that and track what one purchaser may be doing at different stores?
Chair Krieger, Representative McPherson, yes. However, what we would need eventually is
back up.
Yes, there is. Currently what we do is with the iodine, we do track sales of iodine, we do track sales of MSM through tack and feed stores based on percentages and amounts. And what happens right now is that we have those sent into my office, and we have the courtesy of the Postal Service that provides us envelopes, so there's not a cost to us, that we provide in turn to the tack and feed stores, and they send those forms in every 30 days. Those forms then are put into what we call a case management system, and we have that ability to track. We could do the same, and the Department of Justice puts it into the case management system. It comes into my office. We track it as coming in, then it goes into the case management system. We could do the same with these logs through on the sales. However, and it's, as I mentioned before, we've already reduced down to a quarter of what the sales were before. And as an example, when they looked at convenience stores should have been selling around $46 to $48 worth of pseudoephedrine per month. What they were selling was around $750 to $1,500 of pseudoephedrine per month. That's the REACH-A-CAR study by DEA. It's confirmed by industry reports, and now there's further studies that I can also get for you if you would request them. However, what that won't do is that right now we have the 9-gram and 30-day limit. And the issue there is that if we don't have a computer system at the pharmacy where they're able to connect with all 750 or 60 pharmacies, is that if I'm at a Safeway pharmacy in Portland, I don't know that this guy just went to Bend and purchased. And so there's a problem there. There's a disconnect. Now, we could in lag time, get the information back out to the pharmacies and let them know these are people who are doing multiple purchases. But it wouldn't be at point of sale. So that would be a problem.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker, did you have a question?
I did.
Yet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that I understand, gentlemen, are you suggesting that Theraflu be available by prescription?
Senator Walker, Chair Krieger, Theraflu out of all of these, and which I personally did myself on the Theraflu, I extracted the pseudoephedrine. It was the prettiest material out of all extracted. It was nice and fluffy white pseudoephedrine. So that's what I have to say on my results. I don't know about...
Okay, well, I understand your results, but my question is, if we're going to put all these things by prescription, are you telling me that an Oregonian who has the flu in the middle of the night gets up and they don't have Theraflu and they're covered because they have to call their doctor to get a darn prescription?
Chair Krieger, Senator Walker... The issue, I think when we look at what can be converted to methamphetamine. I can tell you that if we leave one product out there that converts, as they've already proven, to pseudoephedrine, you're going to have meth labs. And if you leave one product out there, that will be the product that all of our meth cooks will go to. As witness, it only took them 4 months to go to gel caps, figure it out. It took them 6 months to go to liquids and figure it out. And now that's what they will be getting. But also on the same note is that all these companies are turning over to phenylephrine. So Theraflu will have, or I would imagine a product like it will have phenylephrine. And as I think Mr. Rice will testify here, that once he contacted doctors that are allergist doctors, a very small percentage of their patients require pseudoephedrine as opposed to phenylephrine. So when you take and look at the legitimate sales going from 100% down to 25%, and then you drop down to a very small percentage of those people actually need pseudoephedrine, it's a very small percentage of the population as opposed to the risk of leaving any product out there available to be converted into meth labs.
Thank you for that answer, Mr. Chair. I have two follow-up questions, if I might. The second one is, gentlemen, since you want to make everything a prescription, it's my understanding of the law that if you are in possession of a drug without a prescription, you're in violation of the law. So if I possess Theraflu and I don't have a prescription label on it, am I breaking the law?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think potentially you could if you had a product that you had acquired after the effective date of this act that had a lot number and a DA wanted to prosecute you for that. I suspect that even under that circumstance, that's not going to happen. They go after meth cooks. I would also suspect that if you tried to apply that law to people that had possessed it in their medicine cabinet and had it there for 2 years, you'd have an ex post facto problem. So I suspect it wouldn't be charged for that additional reason. It would be dismissed ultimately. But you know, I'm not sure how to specifically answer what you're getting at. And in terms of the Theraflu issue, just a real quick comment. Theraflu is already behind the pharmacy counter. So right now, as we sit here in Oregon, if somebody needs Theraflu in the middle of the night, if it has pseudoephedrine in it, it's not a liquid and it's not a gel and it's behind the pharmacy counter.
Right, but it's not available by prescription. You just go to the pharmacy counter.
Assuming the pharmacy's open at 2 a.m.
Right. Okay. Well, the reason I ask these questions about Theraflu is my son uses it all the time. He finds it the most effective method when he's sick and has the flu. I don't like it. I don't use it, but my son does. So let me ask another question, because I'm real worried that Oregonians are now going to be violators of the law by being in possession of these products without a prescription. You go to another state, you pick it up, you bring it home, you have it in your suitcase. You're at the airport, they're inspecting your bag. Aha! They have pseudoephedrine in their suitcase and they don't have a prescription, even though it's a small bottle. My third question, my last question, Mr. Chair, is the question about wholesalers and why we don't license them in Oregon. I want to ask you about that, because there was testimony from the previous witnesses that that's our problem in Oregon, is that we don't license those. So can you address that, please?
Chair Krieger, Senator Walker, first, on licensing wholesalers, I think that would be a question to ask Blake Rice or the Board of Pharmacy. But even with the licensing of the wholesalers in Washington and other states that we are aware of, as Rob has shown, that it has very little impact as far as the meth labs. If you have a person out there that is looking to get pseudoephedrine, if it's out and available to them, they're going to get the pseudoephedrine and make the methamphetamine. On the issue of, we've talked about this as far as if it was a scheduled substance, one of the remedies to that would be, and I can't speak on behalf of the DA's association, but it could be done, is that the DA could make it a non-custodial event, which means that if it was found and if a officer felt that something's going on here, I have, you know, three or four boxes of pseudoephedrine, and I have these multi-ingredients here, or I just have three or four boxes and there's something suspicious, they can submit a report to the DA's office and the DA can consider prosecution or not. That there would be a non-custodial event, which means there would not be an arrest at that point. There would be nothing on the record or those type of things. So if it's available to them, I don't know the answer why we don't license wholesalers. I do know that DEA gives them a registration in order to be able to sell pseudoephedrine. So they do have that through the DEA.
Okay. Thank you, John. I'll ask that question at the Board of Pharmacy, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the phenylephrine, discussion. I recall from earlier testimony that obviously there is less concern about that because it will not be converted eventually into meth. However, Mr. Durbin, you indicated in 4 months they found the formulation for the first product. In 6 months, they got the formulation underway for the liquid and gel caps. And is there any possibility that in a few more months, phenylephrine will be the next product online?
The phenylephrine can be converted now.
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores. Phenylephrine is different chemically from pseudoephedrine. Therefore, when it's exposed to the same reductive conditions, such as the red phosphorus and iodine, it will not convert to methamphetamine. It will be another structure. It could possibly be converted to methamphetamine, but it would be industrial type of chemical reactions going on. That's really all I can say about it, is that it will not be converted to methamphetamine. What it is converted to is something different, and how that affects the body, there's been no studies that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Two additional questions, please.
Of course.
Thank you. In regard to the cost consideration, I'm fully aware of the significant social cost that this crisis is creating. But has there been an analysis or any question or in-depth look at what the cost will be to people who are uninsured or lower wage workers and uninsured, if they need to go to having prescriptions, and what kind of coverages and what kind of push out that's going to make on, for instance, the health plan? And then in contrast with that, when you also mentioned, well, it's a phone-in prescription, will it not be long before doctors are charging for those phone calls to prescribe? So the cost associated with that, has there been any study done on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I'm not aware of any study being done on that. I had no data to argue one way or the other. Again, my reaction is that all of the pharmaceuticals, some quicker than others, are slowly converting all of their products from pseudoephedrine to phenylephrine. I predict in a couple of years it will be very difficult to get pseudoephedrine products anywhere than behind the pharmacy counter with a prescription anyways. So I think that's where we're heading.
Chair Krieger, Representative Flores, one thing that I will not mention the company, but one of the company's spokesmen told me that, in fact, the products, all the products are going to be converting over to phenylephrine, and the only products that contain pseudoephedrine will be their prescription only. So they themselves, the industry, are doing that type of thing because they see now that, in fact, those products are being converted over to methamphetamine.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Hello.
Thank you. In regard to record keeping, is there not a record keeping provision in the -4 amendments, which is the one that pushes everything behind counter as opposed to Schedule 3?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, yes, there's a log that basically would be adopted. It's already in place in the pharmacy board rules, and so theoretically that would still apply. So there would be logging that would occur, yes, if that's what you're asking.
Follow-up? Is that the same type of record keeping, the logging that would be pertinent to the -3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, no. It's a different type of record keeping requirement under Schedule 3. I think you'll hear from the pharmacy board and the pharmacists, and I'll leave it to them that actually administratively from their perspective it would be easier just to make this a Schedule 3.
Thank you.
Representative Flores, I just wanted to, as far as the Oregon Health Plan issue, my understanding is that, and I think actually I might ask Representative McPherson to explain it better because I don't have an understanding, but there's above the line coverage and below the line coverage in the Oregon Health Plan, and my understanding is that the pseudoephedrine products that would treat colds or allergies would already be a below the line, meaning not covered by the health plan. Is that
I wouldn't profess to be an expert, but what my understanding is that it goes actually by condition rather than by the therapy that's applied to it. But the conditions that are addressed by pseudoephedrine products generally are below-the-line conditions, and it's only a couple of unusual conditions for which there are not very many patients that are above the line and would then have health plan access to for prescriptions to get under the health plan to purchase.
Mr. Chair, I think that's Representative Flores' concern as well as mine that these allergies or asthma situations are not covered under the Oregon Health Plan, and you slap all that stuff into the pharmacy with a prescription and you've got to call a doctor or go in to see a doctor. We don't have the money to do that. Or an uninsured person has to do the same thing. So that's my concern. And as these gentlemen have said over and over again, well, phenylephrine is they're switching over to those products. Well, one of the witnesses testified this drug's been around 40 years. Well, then why didn't they switch sooner? And maybe it doesn't work as well for some people. And I just think putting everything on prescription is going a little bit overboard. If you want to put the pseudoephedrine products on prescription and then the others behind the counter, I think that's much more reasonable. I think that's what Representative Flores is getting at.
Senator Walker,
yes.
How do you equate or evaluate inconvenience and cost to those same people, the poor people, and their children who are going to continue to leave exposed because of access to making labs in their houses? And it is those people's children who we are finding and who we saw pictures of at different hearings that we've gone to. They are the very ones, those children, in those homes from those people who use that other product. How do you evaluate that one is worse? To me, I'm going to be inconvenienced. Yes, it's going to cost me. Yes, it's going to cost them. I understand that. But we're making a policy choice in my mind, in my heart, that's going to be extremely difficult. And anytime I can come down on the safe side as to having another 5, 10, or 10, 20 kids in this state that I've seen in those meth home pictures, I'm going to go that way. And I need you to try to, I don't know if you were at our hearings to see all these. I think you were.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a horrible choice we have to make. It's extremely difficult. You know, I understand how you feel, because I was one of the ones that said, hey, what about my rural communities?
Mm-hmm.
Because Port Orford doesn't have a pharmacy, and Powers doesn't have a pharmacy.
Right.
And that's what the working group struggled with. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need a clarification.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm looking here.
Be sure
to gavel's anyway. I know that. I need a clarification. Senator Walker just said, I think we should put the pseudoephedrine products at level 3 and leave the other things out on the counter behind the pharmacy counter without a prescription. That's what the number 3s do. So I need a clarification what you meant.
Okay. I'd be happy to clarify that. It's my understanding Schedule 3 is by prescription only.
But Matt, let me be clear. What you said was I support making pseudoephedrine products a level 3 and the other products behind the pharmacy counter.
Right. Behind the pharmacy counter but not requiring a prescription. Behind the counter. So, and the logbooks, because as Mr. Lovett testified, I think that was his answer, logs, no, I think that was Mr. Durbin, logs are the key. Logs are the key. So if you keep a log of what people are purchasing, and I think this addresses the chair's concern, if you keep a log and you've got that computerized, we're in a computerized world, that's easy to do, you can track that. But you also allow people to get access to those things, the combination products, like Theraflu is a combination product. Any of the other combination products, you can have access but still have accountability and record keeping.
Mr. Chair, may I just clarify? So did you, what you meant to say was that you support having single ingredient Sudafed products?
Exactly.
Or prescription only and combination products, non prescription. That isn't what you said, so I'm trying to be clear what you said.
Well, that might not have been what I said, but you distilled it down very distinctly, very succinctly, and I appreciate that, Senator Beyer, because that's exactly what I meant. You know, we work very well together, Mr. Chair. We're bipartisan. We work across the aisle, and we work across the hearing room. So thank you. That's exactly what I meant. And
Senator Burdick?
Chair, and you know, for Senator Walker's benefit and the rest of the committee, we struggled with this, you know, differentiating between products.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more, and we saw it up here today, the evidence shows that there is no scientific basis for distinguishing one product from another, because the pseudoephedrine can be drawn out of all the products. So if you're trying to limit access to pseudoephedrine, yes, it might be easier to get it out of the pills, but it is very possible and increasingly being used to get it out of the combination and gel caps and liquids.
Mr. Chair, there was one other point I wanted to bring up, but I can't. Oh, I think it was in response to Representative Thatcher's questions. The temporary rule, the explanation was being given that the temporary rule was from November 15 to May, that placed single entity behind the counters, and then a complete rule went in effect after that that requires a photo ID. So that was May. Is that May this May or May of 04? And then, so I'd like that question answered. Okay. And then, after that has been implemented, have you seen a reduction?
If I, Mr. Chair, if I could answer that question, maybe clarify. The temporary rule went into effect November 15th, stayed into effect until May 14th of this year.
Of this year, okay.
The temporary rule placed all pseudoephedrine tableted products behind a counter and the single ingredient products behind the pharmacy counter. It had a picture ID required, but no log. The permanent rule, which we call the full Oklahoma rule, treated all tableted pseudoephedrine products the same. So there's no distinction anymore under the permanent rule between single ingredient products and combos. All of them are behind the pharmacy counter. All of them require picture ID, and all of them require logging. The only exemptions are for the gels and the liquids, but I need to tell you that Iowa is, we wouldn't be the lead in this sense. Iowa just adopted the full Oklahoma rule and added liquids and gels to it. So everything in Iowa is behind the pharmacy counter.
Okay, my point, Mr. Chair, is that this has only been in place since November to May, and now only since May 14th to today. I don't even know what day it is, June 23rd. So you don't know how it's working. You don't know if simply putting it behind the counter is going to reduce the number of labs and address this problem. So you want to go to the extreme measure without having some study backs and follow backs on that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I think we do know that it's been incredibly effective when we know where the holes were and we're slowly filling those holes. And we don't have to just go off of our own experience. We have the experience of many other states that have tried what we call watered-down versions of Oklahoma, half measures, dealing with just the single-ingredient products, dealing with just the tableted products, not doing the log, not doing all. We've seen all kinds of varieties, but the only two states right now that can claim a significant reduction are Oklahoma and Oregon, the way I define significant and the way the national folks define significant, as the DEA and the National Drug Czar's Office acknowledges now in the report they issued a couple of weeks ago. But we know where we're bleeding from. We know where we've been bleeding from over the past 8 months. We filled some of those gaps, and we're asking you to fill the remainder.
Chair Krieger, Senator Walker, one thing, if I could just respond to the cost, and I think it is important to talk about that, because there was an economist that it came out, and we have this study, and we happen to provide an economist in Portland that did a look at what does methamphetamine cost the community, and he called it a meth tax. And what he determined was, in looking at a bunch of different factors, was that, in fact, every single person was paying $383 a year because of the meth epidemic. There's another cost that I did an economic impact study for the Board of Pharmacy, $43 worth of pseudoephedrine, $19,000 to the taxpayer. That's just up front. That's just to clean it up, get the person incarcerated, the court costs and everything else. That's not long-term treatment and everything else. $19,000 for $43 worth of meth. So the small percentage And again, getting back to, instead of $1,500 worth of Sudafedrin a month at a convenience store, $46 shows what actually should be sold of Sudafedrin. Then if you take and cut that down to what the allergists are saying, of the very small percentage of those patients actually need Sudafedrin, those few people that would maybe have to, yes, pay, I think comparative to the cost to the communities, cost to the public and to the private sector, the cost to the children, all those things is, I think those costs far outweigh the cost to the individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, it's my understanding that in Oklahoma they do not put the liquid and gel, the gel caps and the liquid products behind the counter. Is that correct?
Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, correct. At the time that they instituted their law, gel caps and liquids were not being used, and now we are finding that they are.
Then my follow-up question would be, initially when this law was put in place in Oklahoma, they saw a huge reduction, what, 70-80% in labs. Are they seeing the number of labs increasing now because this technology of extracting from liquids and gels is widely known?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, not yet in Oklahoma. I don't mean to demean Oklahoma meth cooks, but apparently they're not as smart as Oregon meth cooks, and they haven't figured out the liquids and gels quite yet. But Oklahoma is working to go with what I guess you could call the Iowa rule, which is the model rule now, which is treating every single pseudoephedrine product exactly the same.
And if I could follow up on that, I was back in Ohio a year and a half ago at one of their meth summits speaking. It was interesting to note that I had some officers come up to me afterwards and say, thank you. We had a meth cook come out from Oregon and teach us how to cook methamphetamine, our cooks. So we've been seeing methamphetamine cooks for over 20 years. And the Midwest and the East Coast, well, the Midwest maybe the last 5 years to 6 years, and the East Coast is just starting to see them. So whatever is going to happen, and the ability to do exactly what we've seen, that cook down there with the liquid, knowing exactly how to do it, is going to happen here probably on the West Coast first. And what unfortunate is that there's an Internet site, and I passed out a paper on this, and I'd be happy to share it with you. I don't want to share it to the public. But this Internet site, as soon as we change something, they get on there and they put it out on the Internet. And it's going to be very, I'm watching it right now because I'm sure within a very short period of time it's going to be out on this Internet site how to do it, and it spreads across the nation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
You said there was a spike in March, and you said that most of the labs found were still using these hard caps, even though they were multi-symptom sometimes. You're still not finding these. How many of the labs that you're seizing are using the liquids or gels? Apparently there has been somebody using it, but it's not a common thing. Is that my understanding?
Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, we don't know how many are out there using it right now. Typically, we're finding a very small percentage of the labs anyway with our law enforcement comparative to what we know are out there. And case in point, prior to our rule, we estimated based on the iodine MSM cells that we were seeing that we could easily have around 1,000 or more cooks operating in Oregon at any one time. But that's not even close to the labs that we were seizing. So, and again, this has just happened since April. And so as the word gets out there, these labs will be happening. So I'm sure that we'll be stumbling upon more and more and more. And if we were to leave these products available, that's exactly what they would go to as Washington becomes more restrictive when their law goes into place in October and Idaho and other states start to follow suit.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think part of the discussion is basically Schedule 3 or nothing, and I would like to talk a little bit about the alternatives, because I think they also can have a significant deterrent effect on the acquisition of these substances. And in that regard, I would assume that under the Dash 4 amendments, and assuming that the Board of Pharmacy acts accordingly, that there will be some sort of identification process put in place and a record-keeping process put in place as the sales are made. I want to ask the industry representatives or the members of the panel, if this is correct, It's my understanding that the pharmaceutical industry or pharmacies already have computer capacity whereby they are taking the names and addresses of persons to get prescription drugs, and then they're able to cross-reference all that to determine whether certain persons are abusing their prescription drugs. Is that correct? Is that capacity in place?
Chair Krieger, Representative Ackerman, I think that would be a question you'd want to address to Mr. Rice. There was a bill this year introduced into the legislature that actually would put into place a computerized system for pain management, and that, is, from my understanding, has died. And so that would be a question that you'd want to ask Mr. Blake, Mr. Rice.
Thank you. If I could have that question answered, because I know from some my previous experience in litigation in this area at one time, I did become aware that there was a computerized system that all the pharmacies were linked into, where all the sales of prescription drugs were tracked. And I'm just trying to say that's already in place, and that could be a significant tool for deterring purchases of illegal substances.
To just clarify on that point, let me ask you this. If the pseudoephedrine products are just behind the counter and we do the logs, is there any authority in the law currently for those handwritten logs to be computerized?
I don't understand your question.
Well, now, there was a bill. There was a separate bill. There were two bills pending this session, one that would have been all of the pain medication, including the pseudoephedrine, but the other one was limited to an electronic database for pseudoephedrine sales. That bill also is not currently set for a hearing in any committees. And my understanding is that you need that law to do what's now the written logs and computerize them. Yes or no?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Mowat, I think you want to ask that of Mr. Rice as well. I think you're exactly correct, but I'd rather hear Blake tell you about the current status of what we can and can't do. I think it's more about what we can't do.
He'll be up in just a couple of minutes, too.
If I could also just follow up on that, as I explained to Representative McPherson and members of the committee, is that there is the ability to do it, but it would be a very cumbersome system, and it'd be efficient in the sense that we could track, but there would definitely be a lag time. Point of sale would be a problem, and it'd be a cumbersome system, and we'd be using basically FTEs that we currently have in place, and would be no further FTEs with doing that. We'd basically be putting on another duty, another task on people that are already doing a significant number of duties.
Maybe this one's great, but if we have electronic logs like that, and I would assume you'd have to have them everywhere that sells any of this stuff, which would mean all the 7-Elevens, I'd be concerned. And I think there's other groups that have grave concerns about somebody knowing everybody's home phone number, their address, and everything else around the state by some 7-Eleven clerk in Burns looking up anybody they want and knowing what kind of medicine they're having. I mean, I would think there would be all kinds of privacy issues with that would...
Representative Krieger, Representative Barker, I would hope that when we're talking about this, we're talking about if we went to a computerized log, we'd only be talking about the pharmacy counters and not out at the convenience store counters. As we've shown, and there's numerous studies, numerous other states that show if you do leave it out other than the pharmacy counters, you will have exploitation and holes in the system.
Thank you.
Representative Flores?
Thank you. Would you help me understand the distinction between records that would be maintained under the scheduling in the Dash 3 amendments as opposed to the logs or records that would be maintained under behind the counter? Obviously, I've heard you say that the Dash 4s, which are behind the counter logs, are handwritten and not subject, or we do not have the current capability for an electronic conveyance and entry. But we do for the record keeping that's required when it's scheduled.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, That's a perfect segue into Blake Rice, because I think Mr. Rice is going to talk about exactly that issue.
All those things that have to do with the prescriptions and the record keeping and that, let's try to get that to him when he gets up here. Do you have any other questions regarding their testimony or thoughts, anyone?
Yes, just a follow-up statement. I'm somewhat surprised that you're reluctant to get into substantial record keeping under the, which is under the dash fours, when if the dash fours are passed, we gave the State Board of Pharmacy exactly that authority.
Representative Krieger, Representative Ackerman, we're not reluctant in a sense to do it. We will definitely do it, and we think it's worthwhile, and we think it's important to do. However, I was just talking about efficiency, what's more efficient. I think part of the reason for the 9-gram limit is to prevent smurfing, exactly prevent smurfing. If you don't, we'll have to do it on a lag time basis. If we don't have the ability to do it at point of sale like you could have through, well, you would not even have to worry about that with a prescription. But if you didn't have prescription and you tried to do logs, and the logs electronically is what you would need. Somehow you need some kind of ability electronically to enter a person's name at the point of sale and say, sorry, you just purchased over in Bend a box, or you purchased 9 grams over in Bend. That's the efficiency is much better with an electronic capability. If you don't have that, the best is with Schedule 3.
Thatcher?
Yeah, I just have one last thought, I suppose. Wouldn't it follow that since there was such a success demonstrated in reducing labs when tablets were put behind the counter, wouldn't the next logical step be to put all of it behind the counter rather than just go to a sweeping prescription only mandate?
And then
follow it up with the ability to do so if it should still demonstrate that it's a problem.
I'll give it a try. Chair Krieger, Representative Thatcher, we want to get the biggest bang for the buck. We believe that now they're using all the pseudoephedrine products. Phenylephrine is going to be flooding the market as a replacement. So I don't think we need to be cautious about how aggressive we need to be to eliminate. I don't want to see any more children. I'm not willing to sacrifice a single additional drug-endangered child to a single additional meth lab. We were talking a few months ago about banning pseudoephedrine in the state of Oregon. We're backing off of that. I think there's a lot of support in this building for doing something that aggressive. Let's be aggressive. We can be aggressive on pseudoephedrine now. We need to be aggressive on pseudoephedrine now that phenylephrine is hitting the market. We need to drive the manufacturers and the remaining few that are out there that are fighting us here to do the right thing, which is what Pfizer's been doing, and McNeil and a bunch of the others are jumping ship. We need to continue to encourage them to do the right thing, whether it's because they're doing it for the right reasons or for their own economic bottom line dollar. I don't really care. I'm just not willing to sacrifice an additional drug endangered child to an additional meth lab.
If I could just do one follow-up on that, when Rob and I went to this conference, we became very alarmed at what is happening, what you're doing here is absolutely critical to the state of Oregon. And anything we can do to be the most restrictive to stop the most labs that we can possibly stop so that we can free up our law enforcement to go after these drug trafficking organizations and stop the flow of crystal meth that's coming into this state is absolutely critical. And this law is helping to do that because these task forces tell me they're seizing more crystal meth than they've ever seen before. And that is partly because of what's coming in, but partly because they're being freed up. Because we just learned that one trafficker, in Atlanta, supplied Atlanta in a year enough crystal methamphetamine to hit 4 million users one time. 4 million users. And the amount of crystal meth that's coming in to this state, if we don't stop it, if we don't free up law enforcement, if we don't stop these labs, we're already seeing it down in the middle schools. There's 3 cases right now going on of middle schoolers doing exactly what happened here in Salem and throughout the state. So it's getting into our middle schools, it's getting into our high schools, and we do. I think we do need to be as restrictive as we possibly can to stop these labs.
Other questions? Lieutenant, is there any indication that the stuff that's getting into the lower level kids, the lower grades, is that stuff that's being imported, do you feel? Do you have any indication of that, or is it the stuff that's being cook locally by the small labs in someone's house. Do you have any indication?
Representative Krieger, Chair Krieger, and members of the committee, it's hard to say exactly what is getting into the middle schools, because now the small toxic labs that typically produce powder in the past, they're producing crystal. And so the crystal that's coming from down south and the crystal that's here, both of those are on a purity scale that we've never seen before. And that's the problem, is that it's smokable. And so, you know, if we go on what ONDCP is saying right now, it's like 65-35, that 35% of the meth consumed in your state is probably out of the small toxic labs, and 65%, that's the new figure, is from importation. So with it being smokable, before the kids didn't want to do it. I did a lot of talks in schools, and kids didn't want to do a drug that they had to inject or that they had to snort or they had to eat, but that we'd all know that there's smoking going on, that there is use of marijuana and those type of things, and so a smokable form of meth is easy for them to use. And then the purity levels is what we've already heard many, many times, is that there's almost an instant addiction to it. And so that's what is very scary, and that's what's going on.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Have Blake Rice, Craig Campbell, and Mr. Friends, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Craig Prinz, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I think I was asked to come up to address some of the economic issues on this. I find it ironic in one sense, because I think that one of the biggest economic issues that we've dealt with over the last two sessions is the drug companies, the amount of pseudoephedrine products that they're going to be not selling in Oregon is why you're getting as much pushback on this. So I think that's the biggest economic issue that we should be talking about, is why you're getting folks flown in from out of state on this issue. But the other issue that's economics, and the reason I mention that is because, as we've mentioned the last two sessions, those were the people that were saying, only deal with the hard pills, only deal with the single ingredients, don't deal with the multi-ingredients. And we've seen, you know, you all aren't going to be back for a year and a half, and we've already seen that they can make it from all of these preparations. And so the voices that are speaking for caution, I feel, their economic incentive is to keep these products there. I'm not belittling the fact that it will be inconvenient if we have to have citizens going to get prescriptions, but that's the real economic issue, I think, that's driving this. But more on point to what Senator Burdick mentioned, the direct cost of meth labs. Senator Burdick mentioned the study done by Echo Northwest, which they termed the Multnomah County meth tax. Echo Northwest looked at the cost of meth abuse in Multnomah County and tabbed it at $102 million per year, $102 million for 2004. That cost, they tried to assess, and that was $363 per household, which, by the way, would be more than the average cost of Multnomah County's income tax there. But the key that, as Lieutenant Durbin and I think tried to address, you have the opportunity to take a step to deal with the meth lab costs and the meth lab cleanup cost. The estimate there in 2004, it looks like the number of labs that were in Multnomah County alone was approximately 76 reported, and 56 of those were decontaminated to the state's certification level, and then that leaves 20 of them boarded up and in your community, which is an issue that we're really trying to figure out with the meth task force. What's the next step? because, as you know, from the system standpoint, if you're in law enforcement, having a boarded up home is what we call a broken window, and it tends to attract criminal activity to that boarded up home. It's very expensive to clean up a meth house. The estimate from the Echo Northwest is for a three-bedroom house in Multnomah County, with the cost of cleanup being approximately $17,000 for that house. And then the amount of time with the lost rent that you'd have to have a landlord clean that up would put it to $20,000 per house. That's just direct cost of cleaning that meth lab, and that doesn't take the non-economic issues, which are captured in the larger household cost, which are what we've seen as the foster care and the kids being in a toxic environment. So that's the direct cost per house that contains a meth lab. That does not count the meth labs that are in trunks of cars, and that does not count the long-term effect of the children that are in meth labs that you saw with the National Jewish study that we saw in Pendleton, that we don't know what the long-term effects are going to be for these drug-affected children, but I can assure you if they need state assistance, it will be costly, and I don't have a figure for that. But just the direct cost of $20,000 for a three-bedroom house, we are seeing in Kaiser, the Realtors Association is doing something very exciting, which is they've taken the effort of actually buying a meth house in Kaiser, and because they've had the underwriting of the Realtors Association, they're taking that step, and we're finding out with the meth task force how difficult it is, because if you say you're a lender or a lender and you have a mortgage that you could foreclose on a meth house that's been used as a meth lab, you're not going to foreclose on that because it's no longer a piece of collateral. It's a toxic brownfield, basically. So what happens is in your communities, you're going to have boarded up meth houses that are really a seat for criminal activity. And we're working on the meth task force to deal with that. So that's just a point of reference for the economic effect. And in general, I just say that this is one portion of the meth package that we've all worked on so hard. And I urge you I think you're doing a great job. It's difficult on both sides. But I think that the reasons for being aggressive are outweighed by the reasons for being cautious.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Blake Rice. I'm the immediate past president of the Board of Pharmacy and still a member of the board. Just to explain what I passed out, one is a kind of a cooked-down version of what the CFR, the federal regulations for scheduled drugs are. I also gave you a pharmacist handbook that's more detailed of that. I think you've kind of got a pretty good understanding of that from Gary Schnabel, from his testimony when he was here at the last joint meeting, about the differences between 2s, 3s, 4s, and 5s. But if you have any specific questions, I'd be glad to answer those. The other piece of information I passed out was excerpt from a web page from Pfizer who makes Sudafed, and if you'll notice reading down through that, right in the middle it says that their Sudafed and phenylephrine are equally effective, and I have to sympathize with Representative Thatcher. There are patients that certain drugs just don't work as well for, and that's across the gamut of all prescription drugs. One antihypertensive drug doesn't work the same for everybody. That's why we have so many. And so I do appreciate that, her concern about that. Part of the problem with the phenylephrine products is that they haven't been marketed here because Sudafed had such a huge share of the market, and the biggest portion of the marketing is done there. They are available in other countries. One of the drawbacks from phenylephrine that industry mentioned was that you had to take them every 4 hours. Well, that's not exactly true. They do have a long-acting one that's out there in other countries, and so it wouldn't take long to get it here in this country to make it more convenient for the consumer. Speaking from the Board of Pharmacy, the Dash 3 amendment, making pseudoephedrine products, all of them Schedule 3s, is the cleanest way for the board to be able to monitor that. The record keeping is there. Addressing Representative Ackerman's record keeping thing, pharmacies do a great job of keeping records and tracking things within the pharmacy in their pharmacy computer system for prescription medications. Over the counter medications, there is no tracking mechanism for that. The board doesn't have or doesn't require any kind of tracking mechanism for the logs that we have now. Those are all handwritten logs. They'd be required. Somebody would have to sit down at a database somewhere and type all that information in. We did make it, in our permanent rule, we did make it as easy on the retailers as possible. If you have electronic means, if you have some way to do that, you're welcome to keep them that way. Sharing the information, on the other hand, is a little more difficult. There is no interconnectivity between different pharmacies. You don't know if somebody sold something in Bandon, they're in Portland, or they're in rural Oregon. So the record keeping is just not available for those logs. With a prescription log, getting that information is pretty much instantaneous. Most pharmacy computer systems can spit out a report in just a matter of minutes on purchases of any specific drug, patient. I mean, all that information can be boiled down to a pretty specific report very quickly. So by making it Schedule 3 and a prescription, that information becomes easily obtainable quickly. So there's no time lag, as the state police mentioned. It also makes it easier for the retailer to comply. You don't have to have someone out there collecting that data. That's in your database. So it just makes it more a little cleaner for everyone. So that's kind of the board's stance, is that the Dash 3 amendment, with making everything a Schedule 3, the board supports that and would do rulemaking around that to make it every bit as effective as we could. And I think I'll leave with that and try to answer any questions you might have.
Let's get all of them testified first. Oh, okay. And we'll come back. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, for the record, members of the committee, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the governor's senior policy advisor, and I'm here to urge your passage of House Bill 2045 with the Dash 3 amendments. I want to begin, first of all, by pointing out the governor's thanks for your diligent work, both as the House and the Senate committees, and also the work group that was put together to do the detail work on this package. Not only was it an unbelievable display of bipartisanship and a cross between the House and the Senate, but you were dealing with some very intensive issues, and you handled a lot of information very well. So from that perspective, I wanted to thank you for that effort and wanted to extend the governor's thanks for that effort. More to the point of the bill, however, in the broad array of issues that we're trying to address with the methamphetamine problem in the state of Oregon, the primary problem that we're dealing with is the meth labs that are located within the state of Oregon in homes. While the production of methamphetamine from those labs ranges from anywhere from 20 to 35%, they are the core of most of the problems that come out of the methamphetamine addiction, including physical and sexual abuse and neglect of drug-affected infants, children, and toddlers. The creation of toxic waste, the requirement of law enforcement to pay numerous visits to similar locations over and over again for crimes that surround such locations, the effect on hygiene, including such things as the spread of hepatitis and other sexually related drugs, and those that are transferred as a result of needle use and other drug use. The impact on the mental health system, because methamphetamine addiction closely resembles mental health problems and can in fact create such, it's creating a huge burden to that system as well. The bottom line is that we also have the direct ability to impact that 20 to 35% of the problem here in Oregon. We will be able to work with our federal partners to address the other part. But much like all of us, we would like to, if we had the ability to destroy 35% of the cocaine production in Columbia, we would do so in a moment. Here we have the opportunity to do that with methamphetamine in the state of Oregon, and I would urge you to take that opportunity and go ahead and do that. Often when you're talking about changes like this, there are going to be people who are inconvenienced. There's no question about that, and that's always a difficult choice. Along with such choices, there's usually a call for restraint, for reasonable discretion, for an incremental approach, and that usually results in delay and hesitation. In this particular instance, we have methamphetamine cooks who, when you're dealing with them, you really have to deal like you're playing a game of chess. If you're not thinking five steps ahead, your opponent is going to beat you, and meth cooks think five steps ahead. I don't know how, but they do. They're adaptive. they're willing and able to exploit any opportunity that we provide them to produce methamphetamine. While we debate whether multiple ingredient tablets can be used for methamphetamine production, they are using them for methamphetamine production. When we are debating about whether or not liquid gel caps can be used to create methamphetamine, they are using it to make methamphetamine. The problem we have here is that if you leave the window open, you will have to come back 18 months to fix the problem, and that problem will be exploited. And during that period of exploitation, the people who will suffer will be those children and those people who are in meth houses and the communities that are around them. I'll end with this. The bottom line is that the governor, the members of these two committees, the governor's meth task force, and thousands of Oregonians have all seen that meth is literally destroying families in this state. I don't believe it's hyperbole to say it is the number one public safety challenge that we're facing today. It is creating an unbelievable burden on the law enforcement, child welfare, health, and correction systems, not to mention the impact it's having on the citizens who live in communities where meth addiction is present, and there are no communities in the state of Oregon where it is not present. So I thank you for your diligence. I thank you for your aggressive actions, and I would encourage you to adopt the Dash 3 amendments and would also be willing to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, committee, have some questions? Senator Walker first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Things aren't tracking for me, and so I'm going to have to try to get some clarification. When I suggested that we look at the Washington state law, and we got the comment back from Mr. Bovet that Oklahoma's done a much better job, and attached to that email was an interim report from the Interagency Working Group on Synthetic Drugs, dated May 23, 2005. So I'm looking at this, and I'm reading it, and actually one of the neat things about it, Mr. Chair, I don't know that anyone's talked about it in all of our hearings, is the federal government is actually starting to do something, and they will have, they're supposed to be launching a new government website in July called methresources.gov, and that's going to talk about all the best practices around the country to deal with methamphetamine problems. But in this report, gentlemen, I need to read you this paragraph because it doesn't make sense with what you're proposing to do here in Oregon, because as Mr. Bovet indicated, Oklahoma has seen a 70 to 80% reduction in labs. We've seen a 50%. Okay, Oklahoma's seen more than us. Oklahoma doesn't do what you want to propose to do here, because let me read from the report. It is also worth noting that the reduction in Oregon's lab numbers have been impressive, but not as dramatic as Oklahoma's. As discussed earlier, there are two differences between the states' approaches. Oregon has allowed non-pharmacies to sell combination pseudoephedrine products from behind the counter, whereas Oklahoma requires both single and combination entity products to be sold from behind pharmacy counters. It doesn't say anything about a prescription. So Oregon's going out way at an extreme here and saying all products have to be by prescription, yet Oklahoma's reduced their labs by 70 to 80% with the way that they've approached it. So I don't understand why Oregon wants to make regular Oregonians common criminals by possessing something like Theraflu or having to call their doctor to get access to it. So can you help me understand the conflict I'm having?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the report that you're quoting from actually was talking about the results of the temporary rule, not the permanent rule. When we went to the permanent rule, we went to a rule that was identical to that of Oklahoma. We have not had enough time to find out how effective our change has been. And to some extent, the impact on Oregon's numbers are going to be affected by what Washington does. Washington has not made the change that would prevent communities such as Umatilla County, where people will go across the border and buy their pseudoephedrine out of Washington. So to some extent, our number is hedged a bit by those border communities that can go over and get their pseudoephedrine from other states, Washington being the primary one there. The reason we want to go further is because we've seen that as we take incremental steps in this direction, we get better results. And the assumption there is if you continue to go further, you will continue to get better results. 70% and 80% reduction is fine. 100% is much better. So the goal here is to get as far down that road as we can. Obviously, the goal is not to turn common citizens into criminals. And we would hope that once we move pseudoephedrine behind the pharmacy counter and make it a prescription, that those people who wish to continue to use pseudoephedrine products will get a prescription for those, or else they will choose to move to a non-pseudoephedrine product to get their needs met, rather than choosing to break the law by not getting their pseudoephedrine through legal means.
All right, thank you. I'll have another question for Mr. Rice, if I might, since you're with the Board of Pharmacy. No one else could answer this question, so I'm going to lay it on you, and hopefully you can answer it. Why do we not license wholesalers in the state of Oregon?
Actually, that was a misstatement by somebody. Oregon does register all wholesalers in Oregon. Everybody that sells drugs, whether it's just OTC drugs or prescription drugs, have to be registered with the state. By making a Sudafed a prescription, you're able to eliminate the small wholesalers that only deal in OTC pseudoephedrine products that are the biggest suppliers to the mom and pop outlets that sell that $1,500 worth a month out the back door rather than the $40 that they should be selling across the counter. So the wholesalers in Oregon are licensed and with the state. And the differentiation would be that if you made a prescription, the OTC outlets wouldn't be able to sell it. The OTC wholesale outlets could not sell a prescription drug.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on this line of inquiry? The Washington state law, have you seen it? They passed it last year. And I have it here, and it says no wholesaler may sell any quantity of drug products containing ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, the whole list here, if the total monthly sales of these products to persons within the state of Washington exceed 5% of the wholesaler's total prior monthly sales of non-prescription drugs to persons within the state in March through October. And then it uses some other dates. So they require the wholesalers to track their sales. You license them, but do you track their sales?
Chairman Krieger, Senator Walker, we don't have the ability to track their sales. They do have, because they sell pseudoephedrine, they are registered with the DEA, and the DEA does try to track those sales. The problem is wholesalers can get a license, be in operation in a very short period of time, sell a lot of pseudoephed, and vanish. We have wholesalers in Oregon that operate out of garages. They're able to get a license, operate out of a garage until we find out where they're at, close down, move somewhere else. The board is looking at changing the wholesale outlet regulations to try to get around to eliminate that. But currently, the way that the things are written, they can apply and get a license with just by meeting a very bare minimum of requirements.
Mr. Chair, I made my case here. They have garages. They have a wholesaler operating out of a garage. They open up, they close, they shut down. Where is the accountability in this wholesaling business? Why is the Board of Pharmacy now just looking at that? And why are we looking at the consumer to solve this problem when we're not looking at the wholesaler and the distributor? I don't understand it. I'm frustrated by this, and I would encourage you to look at the Washington state law, and it is 18.64.046, revised code Washington, ARCW. I think my case has just been made.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, Senator Walker, that Oregon was out front going beyond what anyone else had. Earlier in your testimony?
Yes, when I read
from... I'll remind you that we did the same thing with the bottle bill, land use, and the beach bill. That's not unusual for Oregon.
Oh, no, Mr. Chair.
And I think you'd agree probably most of those things are good, and I feel we're going to look back on this and find the same.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. Oregon does a lot of very good things. We're the first in the nation on a lot of things. This one just has concerns for me because I don't think we're looking at the back end of the picture. And I appreciate the work group and what they've done. And we've got a really good product here. But for this piece, it doesn't look at the back end and how this drug is distributed.
Friends?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to follow up on what you said. Senator Walker, I just, Thursday and Friday, I was in D.C. for a drug control policy group. And so I had an opportunity to meet with DEA folks and the ONDCP. The reality is we are the leaders, unfortunately, in this, because they're not seeing the meth. They're looking to what's happening in the states. And when I was there, I was sitting next to the doctor from Oklahoma who does their drug control policy. And very tragically and sadly, the only reason we have a model in Oklahoma that works is because a trooper was killed by a meth addict on video. That's what gave the Oklahoma governor the fortitude to say, enough is enough, give me a law that regulates that. And that's how we finally had a state law that was not watered down and was not... We would still be back in the same situation we were the last two sessions if that trooper was not killed on video to really give the political will to that state to take the lead. And I think we're just following that lead when we see that they're already moving to these other products. So I agree that this would put us, I don't think it's an extreme move, I think it's a full measure when we see what's already happening here in Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. Rice in your capacity as you're a pharmacist, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
I know you're on the Board of Pharmacy. So from your technical and scientific experience, if someone comes in to the store and with terrible cold symptoms and they're able to get easily the Sudafed PE or one of the products containing the alternative substance that I'm still learning how to pronounce, what percentage of those people do you feel, based on your experience, if you have enough, would find that product adequate to solve their problem?
Chairman Krieger, Senator Burdick, from my personal experience in my store, most patients will buy the PE product. It's the alternative product. I probably have moved. Most of my sales have gone to those products because the other ones are behind the counter and it's a little easier for them to just pick it up and check it out. I have never had a patient come back and said, this doesn't work for me. I don't have one instance of that. Addressing that concern, I have never heard of a congestion emergency. I don't think that that decongestion is an emergency type situation. You don't wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning and just have the decongestant. It started earlier on than that. Most patients are aware of their symptoms and they've had a cold, they've had the flu, they know what they can, what they use, what they like. As all the manufacturers will move to those alternative products, the TheraFlu products, those products that people like, because of the way they're made, combination products, you don't know which ingredient there is giving you the best relief. I mean, if you have five ingredients in there, you can't say the Sudafed is what's working. You can't say that chlorpheniramine is what's working. It's the combination, the acetaminophen, all those things work in concert and you get relief. So from my experience, most patients will, their initial response is to just go ahead and get the PE product. If they've already been, you know, they might have tried it and they come back in, they'll ask for a specific product, whether it's the antihistamine decongestant combinations like Claritin D and those kind of things. They'll ask for those and do the log. More often than not, it's the one on the shelf that's right there. They pick it up and they just don't bring it back and say it's not working. It must work.
So in your experience, it works, but let's just say that somebody does have a strong preference for one of the Schedule 3, if we adopt the -3 amendments. They can be refilled up to 5 times within a 6-month period. And what is the shelf life on these products?
Most OTC products have about a 2-year shelf life. Some of them are less liquid, sometimes have less. It just depends on the product and the manufacturer. But generally, it's a couple of years.
So basically, I mean, with 5 prescriptions available within a 6-month period, wouldn't it be possible for somebody who knows they really like this product to get in effect, a two-year supply with one doctor prescription?
Correct, and they wouldn't have to go back to get another prescription. All it requires is the pharmacist to contact the physician and say, Mrs. Smith needs her Sudafed refilled, and they'll authorize that one plus five more. Rarely are they would they want someone to come back, and we see that now with the allergy medicines like Zyrtec and Clarinex and those kind of things. They'll fill the prescription for a year for the patient or 2 years. When that prescription's up, they don't say, send them in, I have to see them. They say, I'll authorize another 2 years. If they're working and they don't have any problems with them, go ahead and dispense another 2 years worth, you know, let them get.
So basically what you're saying is that most people would not even have to go to the prescription route. And of that, whatever size group that does, one doctor's visit, and they could basically have unlimited access. Is that correct?
Pretty much, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Ackerman?
Yes, my question is to the pharmacy industry or interests. Under the Dash-4 amendments, the State Board of Pharmacy would have the authority to require record keeping, which could be transmittable to the Department of State Police. Do you think if the Dash-4s were adopted, that the industry would accept the most rigorous reporting requirements in order to identify potential abusers of these abusers of these substances? Even if it's going to cost them some more, do you think they would accept that?
Chairman Krieger, Representative Ackerman, the biggest problem that we heard in testimony when we passed our rule, the permanent rule that requires the record keeping, was that it's onerous on the pharmacy to do that, especially if you have a paper record. Someone has to collect that information, write it down. If we went to the Dash-4 amendments and we were required to, in addition to writing it down, putting it in some kind of format and send it to the Board of Pharmacy or the State Police, I think a lot of pharmacies would probably opt not to sell those products. And I see that in my area already. A lot of the pharmacists have said, I'm just not going to stock the products. Well, they left the gel because we left the gel caps out over the without that, we're going to stock those and the PE products, and we're just not going to have that separate area that we have to keep the records for. They just dropped it, and I know at least three pharmacies in Douglas County that just don't stock the ones you have to have record keeping for, just for that reason.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, but I just was reading this pharmacist manual, and I haven't digested the whole thing, but it appears to me that federal law already requires pharmacists to obtain information on refills, particularly about all the vital statistics about the patient's name, address, quantity dispensed, date of dispensement, and on and on and on. So my point is, isn't the pharmacy industry already doing some amount of record keeping? Doesn't already have that infrastructure in place? We're talking about a small incremental cost for a rigorous reporting requirement to stop methamphetamine use. Do you think the industry in Oregon will accept that?
Chairman Krieger, Representative Ackerman, I think the industry would support, being one part of that industry, I won't speak for everyone, I think pharmacies would support the Dash-3 amendments, that information is already being collected. The Dash-4 amendments would be in addition to that, because it would not be a prescription, but pharmacies wouldn't be required to collect the same amount of information. When you have a prescription record, it requires all that specific information. When you don't have a prescription, that information is not required. The Dash-4 amendments would require additional paperwork for the pharmacy, where if it was a prescription, they already have that in their database.
And my point is, are they willing to accept that burden to engage in the war on methamphetamine? Are they going to join the fight at that level?
I would hope so. I would hope so. I personally would do that.
Thank you.
But whether the industry would accept that, I mean, they seem to vacillate a little bit. Industry has a lot more. I mean, there's economic interests to speak to as well.
Well, that's what I'm afraid of. The economic interests of the pharmacy are going to supersede the public interest in curtailing methamphetamine use.
It should not. I personally, as a pharmacist, would not. I would accept that responsibility if that's what this committee decides. That I would do that.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prinz, in regard to your comment about proceeding with caution, I want you to understand that my concern is far less about the profit or the sales of the pharmaceutical companies in Oregon as it is, or the impact, the cost to families who are just above, at, or below poverty level, and we're not hearing a lot of discussion on that impact. Mm-hmm. That concerns me. Mm-hmm. And I, it can, and coupled with that, having just returned from a Washington, D.C., and a federal conference, where is the federal plan, and how far out is it?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Flores, my father, first of all, is a physician, and we talked about this last night, and I agree that it is a balance. I was just trying to, perhaps I was speaking out of my frustration from the last two sessions when the arguments about multi-ingredients, single ingredients, I think bore the day when in reality, I think that's what made those last two legislative pieces not work. So I agree with you that there is a balance there, and I understand that your concern is for the folks that are going to be bearing a cost for that. And I talked to my dad about that too, and I think the difficulty is what Representative Ackerman brings out is we don't have an ability to use the logs, if they're written logs, the way we could a prescription. And the work groups that we talked about, it's those same rural communities and impoverished communities that are bearing the costs of the meth labs themselves. So I don't see it as it's going to cost either way, but I agree with you, and I understand what you're saying. I didn't mean to say that your calculus is that of the pharmacy company. So if I gave that impression, I misspoke, and please excuse me.
I was not taking that personally, but I just think the record has not been fully developed in that regard.
I think, and I agree with that, Representative Flores. And then to answer your question about the federal plan, it sounds like some of the members have the interim report, I think is what they're referring to, which was released in May. And that the best way I could describe the federal plan is they're trying to work with, they've worked with Canada to eliminate a lot of the diverted pseudoephedrine that was in Canada. And so what we're seeing is Mexico is really the source for the diverted pseudoephedrine. And so I know that the federal agencies are working at the level of at that level with the Mexican authorities to try to regulate those that already have I think the term they used is a permit to sell pseudoephedrine, and they're trying to regulate that. And I don't recall if that information is in the interim report that some of the folks have, but I'll make sure that you have the interim report, and then I'll get the information about the very latest, what they're trying to do. But I think that the federal controls are looking at getting that diverted pseudoephedrine in Mexico. And so I'll get you the best information I can on that.
Thank you. Regarding the State Board of Pharmacy, if we're looking at the dash fours, it says that they could adopt rules placing additional requirements. Could those requirements include requirements for prescription for these products?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, the Board of Pharmacy can make an item a prescription. We can't schedule an item. We can't make it a scheduled drug. That has to be done by statute. There are exemptions and exceptions, and so we possibly could do that if the language allows that. I'm not familiar enough with the dash four to really look at that or answer that question. I don't know if Greg or anybody else has looked at it enough. Maybe. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, I've looked at them. I think the key, and I don't have them in front of me, so I think that I think if you look at the dash 4 on page 9, line 2, you'll see a reference to ORS 475045, and it says, notwithstanding that statute, the State Board of Pharmacy may adopt rules. Here's my understanding of what that would mean. That statute would say that the pharmacy board could not make it a scheduled substance. With the notwithstanding, I think that the State Board of Pharmacy could. And I think, I can't remember who said, but if you look at our current OARs, the Oregon Administrative Rules, that the Pharmacy Board has promulgated, you'll see that pseudoephedrine and ephedrine are currently Schedule 2, which is a higher standard. That is usually reserved for the only, I think I've got a list of the other ones that are Schedule 2. That's for things like OxyContin, Percocet, heavily abused, high abuse potential with severe dependence liability. So what we have currently, and it took me a lot, I had to go over this many times, federally, pseudoephedrine and ephedrine are not a controlled substance. They're a list one substance. In Oregon, under current rule, it is a controlled substance Schedule 2 under the rules of the Pharmacy Board, but there's this exemption for over-the-counter. So long story short, I think that my interpretation of the Dash 4 is when you look at page 9, line 2, where it says, notwithstanding the statute that says they may not put on a schedule a I think the term is in that statutory section is a non-narcotic, thank you, that they would be able to.
Follow up.
Committee and members, we're going to have to be on the floor. We need to do what we're going to do. There's one question left, and I'll give you 1 minute for an answer, and we're going to move the bill.
I just want to clarify. So the short answer is, yes, you could make the rules, making it a prescription.
I think they
could. Okay, thank you. And, one more follow-up. How long would that take?
At least 180 days.
At least?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to make sure we understand. We are in work session on 2485. Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2485.
Representative McPherson has moved the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2485. Discussion on the motion.
Just to summarize my reasons for going that direction, Mr. Chair, I don't have any enthusiasm for limiting the access of law-abiding Oregonians to a useful and inexpensive product, but when you compare it against the terrible scourge that meth presents in our state, I think it calls for bold action, and I think this is the level of action we need to take.
Okay. Dash 3s are moved into the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2485 as amended, that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and that the bill be reported out to
budget. As a technical matter, we have to rescind the joint Ways and Means.
That referral be rescinded and that the bill be moved from the committee with a due pass recommendation and sent to the Committee on Budget.
Okay, Representative McPherson has moved that we rescind the reference to the Ways and Means Committee, pass the bill out, and with a referral to budget. A discussion on the motion.
Just to clarify, I prefer the Dash 4s, and but I will
That's
be voting
table,
for
it.
I will be voting
vote.
For it. Yeah, I will. That's fine.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
I'm going to vote yes, just so we can get this thing moved out and more discussion on it. Aye.
Representative Flores?
I will give a courtesy aye vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Thacker?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
I also will give a courtesy vote, yes.
Vice Chair McPherson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Aye. House Bill 2485 moves with a referral to the Budget Committee. They're going to need us down on the floor.
Floor is at ease right now, so they need you
for us
immediately.
They're waiting on the meeting.